apologies for the first round. I hope that's in order, sir. Having said that, with the opening remarks and everything else, you will have about 15 minutes, still about quarter to, sir, to give us a presentation, and then we'll open up to members. Thank you, Mr. Master.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Chair. Your apology is duly accepted. We acknowledge that. Hopefully it wasn't deliberate, and yeah, we acknowledge it as part of the movement. I'm representing Black First, Land First. I'm the national spokesperson for the movement. Our president couldn't be here today because of the logistical changes and challenges that we face. I'll go through the presentation as you see it before you, but I'll focus on particular areas that speak to the particular submissions that we make as the movement, going through public funding, private funding, and then particularly how we aim to redress or speak to the regulation to move us away from an institution or funding model that allows and basically embeds corruption within the political organizations of this country. And then speak to the repeal of the IEC's deposit requirement and why we think that it's critical to open up the democratic platform for society. And yeah, so let's start at the beginning. Public funding. The Public Funding of Represented Political Parties Act 103 of 1997 established the Representative Political Parties Fund to finance the parties represented in Parliament and in provincial legislatures. The said act makes provision for the President of the Republic of South Africa to issue and promulgate regulations elaborating those details that are not directly provided for in the act. The fund is accordingly regulated in terms of the Public Funding of Represented Political Parties Regulations 1998. In the first leg of this process, all civil society organizations and other interested individuals and entities were invited by the Ad Hoc Committee of Funding of political parties to comment on the Public Funding of Represented Political Parties Act, which then led to the committee considering those views and putting together and publishing the draft party funding bill. In this context, it must be stated that in terms of the allocation and payment of funds to represent political parties, the effect of the provisions of Clause 6 of the draft political party funding bill in no way suggests any material deviation from the relevant provisions of the Public Funding of Represented Political Parties Act and the regulations. To this end, in terms of Section 5.2a of the Public Funding of Represented Political Parties Act, funds are allocated in accordance with a formula that is based on proportional representation of the members a party has in the National Assembly and in the provincial legislatures, and a minimum amount that serves as a threshold so as to promote fairness and equity. Accordingly, the regulations make the following provisions in Regulation 2.2a and b. The allocation from the fund to be made and paid to each of the political parties concerned are calculated by a. Allocating 90% of the total amount of funding determined in terms of sub-regulation 1, proportionally in accordance with regulation 3, and b. Allocating 10% of the total amount of funding determined in terms of sub-regulation 1, equitably in accordance with regulation 4. Furthermore, the determination of the proportion allocation is elaborated in regulation 3 as follows. 3. The proportional allocation is determined by dividing the amount contemplated in Regulation 2 proportionally among the participating parties in any legislative body referred to in Section 93A of the Act in accordance with the number of seats awarded to each participatory party in the National Assembly and the provincial legislatures jointly. As alluded to above, in terms of the regulation, 90% of the financial year allocation is paid proportionally in relation to the aggregate of each party's seat representation, the total seats of the National Assembly and provincial legislatures, and the balance of the 10% of the fund, as indicated in the regulation 4 quoted below, is proportionally divided between the provinces in accordance with the number of seats in each province. To this end, the provincial allocations in turn are equally divided between the parties in each of the legislatures. Regulation 4 settles equitable allocation as follows. The equitable allocation is determined in the following manner. The amount contemplated in Regulation 2.2b must be allocated to the respective provinces in proportion to the number of members of the respective provincial legislatures as contemplated by Section 105.2 of the constitution, and the allocation to a particular province in terms of the paragraph A must be divided equally among the participating parties in the legislature of the province. Clause 6 of the draft political party funding bill provides entirely as follows: allocation and payment of money to represented political party. The commission may only allocate money from the funds to a represented political party. Any allocation from the funds must be made to a represented political party in accordance with the prescribed formula. 3. The prescribed formula must be made on A, in part an equitable allocation taking into account a weighted scale of representation for an allocation to a political party with representation in the National Assembly or any provincial legislatures, and B, in part a proportional allocation taking into account the relationship that the number of a political party's representatives in both the National Assembly and the provincial legislatures bears to the sum of the seats in these legislatures. The Commission must apply the prescribed formulas taking into account the number of representatives of each political party and the number of seats in the representative legislatures based on the results of the election. The effect of public funding on party performance. The allocation of public funds in terms of the draft political party funding bill, as well as in terms of the public funding of represented political parties and regulations, hinders the development of small political parties and hence undermines participatory democracy. The situation effectively encourages parties to enter into corrupt arrangements so as to source funding to supplement the public funding they receive from the state of coffers. A case in point there would be Mazzotti when he paid $200,000 to register the Economic Freedom Fighters, we know, a few years ago, and how that related to him having pending SARS cases and so forth on his end, and how do we then regulate it with taking that into consideration. To this end, the huge difference between the public funds allocated to the African National Congress and the Democratic Alliance due to the number of seats they obtained in the National Assembly and provincial legislatures as compared to the other parties will continue via the proposed provisions of the draft political party fund bill. To address this challenge, BLF proposes the following remedial action. Indicate a definite percentage allocation so that a new provision in this regard will accordingly read as follows. The allocation from the funds to be made and paid to each of the political parties concerned are calculated by allocating 60% of the total amount of funding determined proportionally. The proportional allocation shall be determined by dividing the amount contemplated herein proportionally among the participating parties in any legislative body in accordance with the number of seats awarded to each participating party in the National Assembly and the provincial legislatures jointly. Allocating 40% of the total amount of funding determined equitably. The equitable allocation shall be determined in the following manner. The amount contemplated herein shall be allocated to the respective provinces in proportion to the number of members of the respective provincial legislatures as contemplated by Section 105(2) of the Constitution. And the allocation to a particular province in terms of paragraph 1 must be divided equally among the participating parties in the legislature of that province. On private funding. I'm going to go straight into the conflict of interest. I'm going to skip the first part just for time's sake. I'm sure you've read it already. Evidently, private funders traditionally fund particular political parties with the intention of securing their own political or other interests. This gives rise to a conflict of interest amounting to corruption, which in turn serves to undermine the connection between the political party concerned and its voters. There's a need to create conditions conducive for participatory democracy to thrive and not to be distorted by money. Any party that is in power or is in close proximity to power, to this end, is ineffective in a better position to influence the policy direction of the country, is likely to attract funding from dubious donors. Case in point is electoral candidates currently, even within parties, who get funded from persons like Rupert and so forth, so to move policy and structure of the white economic structures of this country and maintain the status quo of the country itself. While some political parties to their representatives may resist this kind of funding, others may be seduced by the strappings. The draft political party funding bill makes provision for certain prohibited donations. To this end, clause 9 states, okay, you've obviously got that, prohibited donations. Let's go into the proposal to regulate against corruption in this regard. BLF accordingly proposes the following rules to regulate against corruption relating to the funding of political parties, including the electoral campaigns. Political parties must get both public and private support. Both the state and the other entities, including citizens, should be free to give support to political parties. Objective, fair and reasonable criteria should be applied regarding the distribution of both private and state funding. The draft political party funding bill mimics the public funding of Represented Political Parties Act in relation to public funding allocation to political parties. As pointed out above, regarding clause 1 of the draft political party funding bill, the fact that a political party is allowed not publicly to disclose the amounts received by it beneath the prescribed threshold provides opportunity for corruption. To this end, the draft political party funding bill does not give the necessary assurance by putting in place the appropriate mechanisms so that it can support from the state and the entities citizens will not undermine the independence of the political parties. Private funding includes funding from foreign donors. The political party should be facilitated by the following regulations which the draft political party funding bill does not lay the basis of. Prevent the conflict of interest situation from occurring. Promote full disclosure of donations. Prevent clandestine or secretive donations. Avoid prejudice to or undermining the program of political parties. Guarantee independence of the political parties. BLF accordingly calls for the total disclosure of all private funding and the current political parties. We further ask that going forward political parties be prohibited from directly receiving funds from private donors. We propose that an independent political party fund commission be set up so as to receive the administer funds that are given from private donors. That is to say, all funds then, so let's say in BLF's case, people think that we get funded from the Guptas. If the Guptas wanted to give us money, put it into the independent political party fund and then allocate it even to the DA or to the FFP Plus, even though they don't adhere to the policies that we speak to. So it opens up the democratic space and ensures that we secure democracy in this country and not allow ourselves to be controlled by people like Johan Rupert. To this end, private donors must be compelled to reveal their identities. Tax deductibility of donations to political parties. We ask that any tax that is deductible in respect to donations of political parties must be limited. Donations by state-owned or controlled entities, public authorities or other entities that are state-owned or controlled must be prohibited from making donations to political parties. Donations to political parties by legal entities. Donations to political parties from legal entities must be properly recorded in the books of such legal entities. Furthermore, all shareholders of other members of the relevant legal entities must be informed of such donations. Limitations on electoral campaign expenditure. Any funding needed for political parties relating to electoral campaigns that are excessive must be curbed. To this end, the amount given to political parties from private funds must be limited. It can't be right that some political entities run their campaigns like they are running sports shows and others are unable to do the same. We're not interested in popularizing politics to the end that it maintains the status quo, but rather popularizing politics to the end that can change the status quo that means that the black majority remains outside of the economy of this country. Expenditure on records must be kept. Proposed records of all expenditure relating to the electoral campaigns of each political party, each list of candidates and each candidate must be kept. Books and accounts must be kept. Political parties and those entities connected to such political parties must be required to keep comprehensive and consolidated books and accounts. This should include the accounts of the relevant associated entities. Recording all donations. IEC to monitor and supervise both funding of electoral campaigns and political parties. We must be able to control how much money, again we state, must be able to control how much money is used within electoral campaigning. Obligation to present accounts to the IEC, obligation to publish lists of private funders and amount of funds received. Specialized capacity. Capacity should be developed in relation to the judiciary, police or other personnel towards combating the illicit funding of political parties and electoral campaigns. Penalties. The contravention of any provision of the law relating to the funds of political parties and electioneering campaigns must be subjected to the appropriate penalties. The penalties provided for repeat offenders in the draft political party funding bill should include referring of the responsible persons concerned in the relevant political party for criminal prosecution and upon conviction to be appropriately punished. And then just the final one, call to repeal the IEC's deposit requirement. I think this is very critical if we want to have a truly democratic South Africa. Political parties are currently required to pay an amount of 600,000 in order to contest elections in the whole country. This amount, 45,000 per province, 200,000 nationally. BLF calls for the repeal of the provisions of the Electoral Act, number 73 of 1998, which confers powers of the IEC to make determination and to impose the deposit in question, requiring a deposit be paid before a party can be considered eligible to contest the elections. We submit that each political party who wishes to contest must have at least 50,000 signatures to show that they have the capacity of garnering votes and to ensure that they can participate and have expression within the majority or the people of this country. We reject the imposition of the deposit. It is both unfair and unreasonable to new entrants to elections. Furthermore, it benefits those political parties that have access to huge and sometimes dubious private funding over those who don't. I mean, also we must consider that every citizen should have the right free to make political choices, to form political parties. How then do we maintain those freedoms when we say that you must pay 600,000 to participate in the electoral system, while we know that some have access to that money from Franschhoek and Stellenbosch at the drop of a hat? Thank you.
Okay. Greetings to the committee. My name is Madisa Mbemnyama. I'm the chairperson of BLF. I would like to humbly apologize for being late. I'm a working class young man, and I use taxis sometimes. I just want to supplement this one, the last one, the repealing of the IEC deposit requirements, as an attack on democracy itself, participatory democracy. Because, for instance, if you want to find expression in the national discourse about the direction that this country is going, and you can't raise that money, it means that though you want to have, maybe you have a different view about how even this house is being used, you can't access that. A lot of our members in BLF and some of us as even leaders, we can't be able to pay such an exorbitant amount of money. And democracy in its apex is about all voices finding expression and being accorded the respect it deserves, whether people are poor or not. And we think that this still panders to old notions, right, of closing the democratic space for those apartheid damaged and who are still living through the legacies of apartheid. But it's like DA, for instance, they have, you know, large pools of money which they gather from even Zionists. And we know, for instance, the ruling party spent almost close to R1 billion electioneering us as young black kids who want change in this country outside of the mainstream political parties, can't find expression in this country, but were born in this country and we want to move this country forward. So hence, as BLF, we say we reject with the contempt it deserves the imposition of the payment on young black people who want to see this country moving forward in an equitable manner. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I should have indicated earlier on, Honourable Matthijs will join us in a few minutes. You know that we compete with many other committees. Honourable Singh, I think, is at the Eskom inquiry, and Lakuda and others will join us later. So members will join us as and when they can, and tomorrow will be the same thing. I know that Comrade Gordy tomorrow will be busy somewhere early in the morning, so members will join us as and when they come about. Thank you very much for your presentation, gentlemen. Committee, anybody wants to engage with it? Remember, we're not fighting with anybody. We're seeking clarity so that we can take whatever you're giving us and incorporate it if we think it makes sense to do so. So when members ask questions, it's not to fight with you, but it's to seek clarity. And while you're doing that, let me kick off an indication to you that your first point that you made, that the 90-10 is actually not desirable. We took that decision, and that you can rest assured that will be addressed. that the 90-10 will be addressed. Exactly what it's going to be, you'll probably know later this week. But the point that 90-10 is unfair to the smaller parties, that point has been taken. So, and I'm saying it so that anybody else that comes and presents, honourable members and colleagues, that is done. Take it from us that the 90-10 is done. It's not going to be 90-10 going forward, even those that are watching on TV. It will be addressed in a manner that seeks to talk to the spirit and letter of Section 236 of the Act, or of the Constitution. Any other comments from other members? On Comrade Gode.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. And just to indicate that I do have another meeting coming, yeah, so I might have to dash at some point soon. Well, in the first instance, let me thank our comrades from the PLF for their presentation and their effort, especially to the extent that whenever we're processing legislation in Parliament, it is usually those who have the means who always come in with presentation. And those who have the means have the ideology of those who have the means. And therefore their input and influence on the direction of processes will always have the footprint that reflects that element. And the fact that in this process so far we've had a ZAPO and we've had the PLF coming to make a presentation, I think for me it's a breath of fresh air to try and get inputs from the other side, which has remained in the margins up to now. So I'd like to thank them very much for that effort and the clear sense that they've actually gone through the bill and responded to specific areas and sections of the bill. I think in large measure, Chair, I find that their inputs are not that very inconsistent with a number of things that have already been touched from a point that seeks to improve what we have. 2 points from me. One, it is on the issue of the deposit. Because I assume that the basis that a deposit places a restriction. It is restrictive. Now, restriction is not only monetary. You remove the monetary requirement, but then put another requirement that says, get so many signatures. If you don't, then you are out. Just as the IEC says, pay so much amount, if you don't, you're out. So I'm not sure whether the principle that the PLF stands for is remove restrictions, or it is a case of what kind of restriction do you put in. I'm just saying, I'm seeing an inconsistency which might not be there, so I'm sure that can be clarified. And secondly, I thought, unless if I misunderstood the presentation, if I'm right, I would have expected the PLF to say this previous position was correct, the amendments that you have made are wrong, we think you should go back, or unless they did not, they just glided over it, but it's a very important element that, as you know, Comrade Chair, we have puzzled over it, the issue of the equitable share. I think in their presentation, in terms of the amendments, yes, the percentages have given what they want, but when they read it, they read the old restrictive regulations that define equitable share as a provincial share. And not necessarily as a share that should go to the provinces as well as the National Assembly. I just felt maybe it's an area that they might have, you know, done without having, you know, noted it. Otherwise, I'm very happy that they came, and I think that the presentation was okay. Thank you, Comrade Chair.
Welcome, Comrade Kumede. Any more? No? Let me ask you 4 or 5. You can't get away so lightly. Did I understand you correctly to be saying that the position is that there should be no direct funding to political parties? Note them, you'll answer them. Are you saying that if company X or Mr. X wants to donate to a political party, that should be banned and it should go to the multi-party democracy fund and then split accordingly? So that's the first question. And then just on the issue around campaign limits, it's not the first time that it's come up. Just let us understand it. Now, let me give you a hypothetical example. Political party Vincent campaigns only in Gauteng. And then you've got political party Mabasutu that has a national food front. Are you saying both those political parties must have the same limit in terms of campaign funding? Because geographically and otherwise it's totally different. We just need to understand that, because I get the sense that you're saying there should be a cap on campaigning. Question is, it might be nice to say that, but how practical is it to do that? So if you could answer that question for us, your idea around campaign limits on campaigns, especially where we have both national and provincial players at provincial government and at national government, for instance. And also even at local government when we get there. Sometimes you have an independent that will only contest as a ward councillor in Ward 1, whereas you have a political party that has got ward councillors and also PR councillors. So when we discuss these things, let's look at the long term. So if you could answer those questions. And then the final one from my side, at the very beginning of your proposal, you spoke about state funding. Am I understanding you to be saying the state must fund the IEC as we're currently doing, or are you saying the state must fund directly to political parties? Because our position here, for instance, is that there should be no state funding directly to political parties. Already they fund the IEC. And that money that they fund the IEC is subject to the 70-30 that you're talking about. Are you suggesting that the state must fund over and above directly to the IEC to political parties? If you could answer those questions for us, we will then consider your responses in our interaction as we go forward. Over to you, Mr. Maastorf, and to the chair, if you guys would like to respond. We're going to give you about 10 minutes, 15 minutes to respond to them. I'm hoping you've taken notes.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Chair. Thanks for the questions, too. The logic, firstly, that we move from SBLF is the decommodification and the personalization of electoral politics. So that must cover the framework of all the answers that we are speaking to. So let's take, for example, or let's take for the first question by Comrade Cody when he asks about the 600,000 versus the 50,000 signatures. We can't modify the process of entering the electoral politics, particularly because we live in a capitalist society that, as Comrade Cody correctly says, leaves many of us outside the margins, even in the space.
Sorry, Mr. Master, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please, we are busy transcribing somewhere. Okay. That if we speak to the mic, it helps us when we follow.
Okay, apologies.
Okay, sir.
So by taking away the 600,000, we open up the space completely. But the personalization or the socialization of politics and ensuring that people become the epicenter of the political framework means also that people must go amongst communities and win the ideas. That is the basis of politics. Then there is no restriction in getting 50,000 signatures if you wish to win. It's not it's not a restriction, it's your responsibility to win your ideas amongst communities. So we're saying we're moving away from the capitalist framework, we're moving from the first primary block that says, look, if you don't have the money, you can't enter. In fact, I could decide I'm going to start a political party, pay 600,000, and not have one person supporting me. We are saying we must place people at the center of politics. So it's not a restriction to say you get 50,000 seats. It's a responsibility. There are many, maybe there's political parties even in Parliament today that form their party before that one person. I think the FF Plus might even be a party like that. That's my view. But we want to move to the personalization, to making people the center of politics. So that's the point on that. So I don't think it is a restriction. I think it enhances the political framework in that way. On the amendments, I haven't seen those amendments. I'm unable to comment on that, so apologies for that. On direct party funding, we don't want direct party funding. We want, again, a situation. So we know, again, the point was made earlier that, I mean, people fund political parties with interests, and those interests are, whether we like to admit it or not, it's corrupt. The fabric of the society is embedded into how people control politicians. So if I'm Johan Rupert, for example, and I want to maintain white monopoly capital, and the ANC is contesting elections, I'm going to fund someone that I've always backed within the mining space like Cyril Ramaphosa. It's just common sense. If I want the dominant ideas of Zionism to continue in society, I'm going to fund the DA. It's common sense. And if I have more money within the global capital system, it's just common sense I'm going to put all my money there. That's logic. That's how capital works. So we're saying, we take capital, we say, look, if you want to push science, I said, no, that's not, we're not putting that in question. Put the money there, we'll spread money there, we'll put it into FF Plus, we'll put it into ANC, we'll put it into BLF, we'll put it everywhere. And now we go to the ground and contest amongst people, real people with real voices. So we move away from the situation where Rupert can give Ramaphosa, he'll probably even fund FF Plus. Hey, it's bad. Hey, but so we move away from that logic. Then on the IEC, no, the IEC must still be the ones who control how the money system works within the electoral politics. It shouldn't come from the state. But what the clause that I think we were referring to, if I'm correct, is to say that it speaks to this idea of the caps. The IC determining the caps of how it functions, including in terms of the 600,000, gives them the right to make the decision. What we are saying is that we must make those decisions here, put those in place, all those checks, and then they must just execute the processes. So they become the administrator of how it functions, but in no way determines all the caps, monetary caps particularly, that then determine how political parties function. I think I've covered the 4 points, if I'm not correct. But I want to make that first point that I made again. There's one more. Apologies. One thing that is particularly sad for me, Comrade Chair, is that we have SRC elections, right? Institutions. And these SRC elections should act as a hub for us understanding and to testing out new ideas. Now, the ideas that you've put forward in terms of provincial, local, they are not new problems. And how you fund or how you give, how you cap the campaigns. Those are not new problems. They exist in institutions too. People run single candidates. They run candidates in different sectors. So they replicate the very system, but at a micro level. It's definitely doable. It's possible. You use a pro rata system. You say, okay, Gauteng has this amount of people living in this. In Gauteng, this is the value, this is the space they must campaign in, this is the political party, and this is the amount of candidates. And you just use a system that says, okay, for this political party running these amount of candidates in this geographical space, they must get X amount of money. And you do that throughout the system of national, provincial, and local. But I think we must always move from a position where if something is wrong, we don't go with it just because we don't have a solution. We work, we find the solution, then we move forward. It can't be right that 600,000 still exists in 2017. It can't be right that people can spend hundreds of millions on campaigning and win elections, not because they have bad ideas, but because they can pay people. So we must move from a position that these things are wrong, Then we move to a socialist, a framework of a people-centered governance that says, look, we do away with those things, we find a solution. Are we proposing a solution, just like you do at UCT here, you do it at UKZN, pro rata spending for candidates, and we say, no more can we do this thing where companies run 100 million campaigns. I mean, if people have, if they've discussed, there's so few seats.
You've got 5 minutes left between you and your chairperson.
I apologize.
You can carry on, but between you and your chair, you've got 5 minutes left.
Thank you. I think
also, I want to return to democracy, right, and the opening of democratic space, and it's not being thwarted by money. This current format, for me, for instance, if I grew up in a South Africa where the PAC got money to fund its electioneering processes in the same manner or close to the ANC, I would have been a PAC member. Because why? I agree with most of the things they say. But because we grew up with the ANC bludgeoning and dominating, I would think, unfairly, the democratic space, a lot of young people find themselves in the ANC. So what happens is that the allocation of funds means that the narratives that young people pick up as they grow up and being politically conscious come from these funding models that we believe are unfair. So what you then see happening is that young people, when they starting to realize, I must make a contribution in saving this country, not like save SA, of course, in a neoliberal way, but in saving SA so that it becomes a inclusive, democratic, and redistributive way, you find that young people get only one narrative, right? We have been bashed with dada. On SABC, growing up, the own, and also we find these people also on TV.
On a 2 minutes, right?
Yeah, I'm moving. So all I'm saying is there should be a cap on, for instance, for elections, you can't go over 500 million, for instance. We say, no. Even if you can get this money, but we must make sure that you spend not more than 500 million. And then you have some lowly BLF with only 1 million. And that is grossly unfair and doesn't infuse the democratic discourse with any fresh new ideas, because our ideas are then suppressed because we don't have access in the same manner as some. Of course, we agree that proportionality in some way is a representation of the popular will of the people. Hence, for instance, we say we don't support those people who say Zuma must go when they have not gone to the people in Tubatuba, in Khayelitsha, to hear what they are saying, but they are saying it here in Parliament because they are working for imperialism. We support proportionality in so far as it is fair and speaks to the will of the people and not just power hungry people and interests that have always kept us poor anyway. So I thank you. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, guys. Really, from the bottom of our heart, thank you very much. It's politics is not for the faint-hearted. I'm saying this to you, this side. Politics is not for the faint-hearted. Don't fight with these young men. But it helps when we get all these views. Some of us, that's what politics is about. You want to come and swear the ANC, it's fine. You think the DA is a Zionist organization, it's fine. One day when you hear, we'll do the same to you. Just accept that that's the nature of politics. So thank you very much, gentlemen. We will certainly take whatever you've said to us and put it in the hats or in the pot. And when we come up with our final legislation, hopefully some of these ideas will have enriched the process, and legislation is a living, dynamic something, so even in 5 years' time, if your ideas have not been incorporated, we could always fight and have them incorporated. I want to thank you very much for your effort and your time, and that then concludes the first session, honourable members. We're going to move directly on to the South African Local Government Association, because they're already here and they're in place. Gentlemen, you are free to leave if you so wish. You're free to stay and listen to other submissions if you want to do that, but thank you very much. Can we then hand over to Salga, and your presentation is in our slides, in our packs, honourable members. We are going to ask you to as we said to everybody else,
thank you very much.
It's helpful, and we'll get to you. We're waiting for, I'm assuming that that's the team. It's helpful if you zoom into the specific areas and you say, on that clause we have a problem, on that clause we have a problem, here we think that you've not covered it, so that members then are able to add that to their document. We did receive your presentation, which was quite lengthy. You're going to have to somehow find a way of summarizing it. You have got half an hour to do your presentation. Cindy's got lots of, she's very generous. She's given you half an hour to do a presentation. If you can do it shorter than that, we'll be grateful, but you've got maximum half an hour. So we'll stop you at 25 to 11, and then members will take questions of clarity. And if you could introduce your team and take it from there.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to the honourable members present here. I'm Lindy Wenta, the Deputy President of SANGA. I'm with Councillor Gomba, who's also part of the committee in SANGA. She's a councillor, and then NEC member. Then we've got the support of our administration. We want to first apologize for our president and the chairperson of this committee. As you know, the president is the UCLG president, is out of the country, hence we are here. But we'll be making our presentation, Honorable Chair, through Councillor Gomba, because they've been here and there are submissions that were done by SALGA. We'll just be dealing with the highlights of the issues that we feel that local government has been omitted, and we feel strongly that all three spheres of government should depart. We'll hand over to Councillor Gomba so that he can present. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair has highlighted and sent the contents of our presentation as highlighted. What then becomes critical for us is to look at the nature and form of the South African state, so that we have got the basis of our presentation. One is that it is on the basis of both the constitutional and the legislative obligatory provisions. The form and character of our democracy, South Africa as a unitary state, and constitutional values and principles, access to information, and the non-committal provisions of the promotion of access to information act, local government objectives, the constitutional mandate of a municipal council, and other prescriptive policy and legal instruments, such as the White Paper on Local Government, Local Government Municipal Structures Act, Local Government Municipal Assistance Act, the Municipal Planning and Performance Regulations, Local Government Municipal Finance Management Act, and other legislations not as quoted currently. When I look at the current political funding status, both constitutional and legislative space in terms of the gap, the lacuna, assumptions for exclusions when we look at it could be and maybe an oversight by the crafters of the Constitution. Because when you go back to the Constitution, you will start to find that there's both mention of national and provincial, but not direct mention and inclusion of the local space. Also, an inherent misalignment between what the Constitution expects of each sphere of government and what it provides in terms of funding for constituency work. When you come to local government, you'll find that we don't have funding for constituency work as local authorities. Again, transformation of the local space from over 800 mainly urban local authorities to only 257 wall-to-wall complex and bigger municipalities that also include the municipalities that you see that they are basically rural. The case for the extension of this benefit to local government. For us, it is about deepening democracy, just promoting accountability and meaningful community involvement. Both are constitutional and legislative obligations for municipalities. The growing trust deficits between municipalities and communities, and the increasing community protests does indicate to us that we do need some kind of intervention in terms of funding for us to be able to get into those areas. And the growing voter apathy, where you find that there's an increase in prospective versus the decline in retrospective voters. The real government community interface happens at local government. Chair, when I say that, it is an emphasis that you don't find communities at both national and provincial where funding is available. The case for the extension of this benefit to local government is about deepening democracy, promoting accountability and meaningful community involvement, which are both constitutional and legislative obligations for municipalities. I think I'm repeating the same slide, sorry. When I go on, sorry. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that, Chair. When we look at the actual SACA, our own actual proposals, which is a differentiated funding model, we are proposing a separate funding regime and management system for ward councillors, and their scope to be limited to the following areas: meaningful community involvement, which is the core of public participation processes, the public education and community awareness, which shall, in its sense, deepen democracy and the understanding of what communities should be doing, and the general constituency work, which shall promote, in its essence, the accessibility of councillors as members of the ward to their communities. The second one is management, accountability, and compliance with the legislation. We felt we should tie that as to how then we should be able to account for that as ward councillors. That the speaker in any council becomes the head and responsible person for community participation. Therefore, the speaker shall assume the political accountability. But the municipal manager will be the accounting officer, as our MFMA directs, but also the auditor general must find space and audit the funds that get to that level. We're then looking at the difference between the ward council and the community-based organizations. We're now looking at community-based organizations. And the scope could be the same, that meaningful community involvement, public education and community awareness, general constituency work. As we deal with these issues, we're mindful that in communities, some people might be independent. The fact that people are independent does not necessarily mean that they don't have a following. So in a sense, you'd want to cluster them and look at them as part of community-based organizations. Management and accountability and compliance with the legislation, still, because it happens within a periphery and an area of the local government, the speaker shall assume the political accountability, the municipal manager as such be the accounting officer, and still the funds be able to open to the audit of the Auditor General. And when you look at this part of community-based organization, we're mindful of the migration to a fully fledged political party funding category that must be subject to meeting the necessary legislative requirements. We are then looking at a separate funding regime and management system for represented political parties. And for us, we're looking at funding windows as constituency funding, caucus funding, funding for the leader of the official opposition, which normally is not there at local level. Even that one of a leading party is not normally there. And campaign elections funding, where people are able to actually do their campaigning. The other one is their scope to be limited to the following areas: the development of the political will of the people. I heard BLF talking to exactly deepening democracy, that people themselves must be having that space, and bringing the political party's influence to bear on the shaping of public opinion. Inspiring and furthering political education, which is fast disappearing from our community levels. And we promote active participation by individual citizens in political life, exercising an influence on political trends, ensuring continuous and vital links between the people and organs of state. Lastly, manage accountability and compliance with the legislation. It is proposed that represented political parties in municipal councils should be obliged to comply fully in the same manner as in provincial and national legislation. And legislatures should be parliament. Maybe that's what I'm making a mistake. Now we're talking to a proposed way forward and talking to the issue of represented political parties fund. We are sitting here, Chair, and feeling that we may be justified, or the ad hoc committee should may be justified to exclude the local sphere of government as a beneficiary of the represented political parties fund in terms of the trust bill, because there is a gap both in terms of the constitution and legislation currently in the country. Also, that would require, in our view, a constitutional amendment, which shall make it possible that when we look at 2021, the paradigm has shifted and the opportunity is better than what it is today. And when we look at this proposal, we're saying SALGA is of the opinion that the multi-party democracy fund, as a new addition in the legislative scheme, created to enable the donor community and other sources to donate funds to strengthen our democracy, is an open opportunity for all the three spheres of government. There is no constitutional and legislative basis to exclude local government from benefiting from this fund. The bill should be amended to include the local sphere of government, which unfortunately currently doesn't. And we're looking at a proposed way forward as to into a phased approach. Phase one that we're proposing could be a multi-party democracy fund, where the draft bill is to include the local sphere of government as a beneficiary of the multi-party democracy fund. And phase two would be the represented political party fund, which needs a constitutional amendment. And in so doing, shall, of course, not be a situation where local government depends largely on how political parties are funded nationally, but rather that there is a particular portion that really is directed to local government, which unfortunately currently is not. And our view is that that matter, unfortunately, is a matter that then got left off by omission from the crafters of the Constitution. Why South Africa becomes a unitary state, but unfortunately local government is not in the same package. As such, the modus operandi in terms of how local government works in terms of its constituencies is quite different from both provincial and national. Thank you, Chair.
Any further additions?
I think, Chair, we are fine, because the detailed presentation was submitted to yourself, hence we are picking up on only the issues that we feel they are unattended.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Here we have it. I welcome Honourable Matthijs. We did get an indication that you'll join us later. Honourable Stubb.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the SALGA delegation. I much admire the work that is done by municipal councillors. I think they do an incredibly hard job, and they're not paid very much by and large, and they're expected to do everything and be everybody's social worker and community worker and nurse and everything else. But having said that, the proposal that is on the table is undoubtedly going to cost a lot of money. I mean, I forget how many councillors there are countrywide, but there are many thousands of them. And if this sort of scheme was to be extended to municipal councillors as well, it would make a very significant financial burden. At the same time as the many municipalities are struggling to pay their basic accounts, I mean, we know for a fact that a number of municipalities owe Eskom millions of rands, and they're under threat from Eskom to shut off their electricity. There are other basic services that are unable to be supplied in many municipalities because of infrastructural decline. Now the question that I'm really asking is, shouldn't one begin at the beginning and get the basics right, solve the funding problem of essential services before one started embarking on a process of empowering councillors, however deserving that might be in and of itself?
Any other comment? No? Yes, Honourable Chase.
Thank you, Chair, and I might have missed some of what was reported earlier, but I came in when you were talking about funding being made available to the official opposition party in local council. Why are you saying only the official opposition party and not all parties? Why would you recommend that in particular? And then what would you probably, I mean, that's something that is sort of administration. So you also recommended, so it won't just be political parties, but it would also be, as Honourable South has pointed out, independents that have run as well. So on the local government level, you are recommending that we not fund political parties, but councillors in particular, if I just can get clarity about that.
All right. Then also, and I think maybe you clarified it and you assisted us, that part of the problem is, as you call it, the lacuna in the Constitution. And there's a committee that deals with constitutional review, so it can't be done by this committee. You'd have to go through that process and then come back to Parliament and having fixed that up, maybe argue the first part of your presentation. The second part, and again, we I think I can follow up on what maybe Honourable Matthijs or even what both members are saying. Here we're talking about represented political parties at the national and the provincial level. And we're not dealing with legislation that must deal with the here and now. We're dealing with legislation that must benefit even my grandchildren. What happens if the vast majority of councillors become independent? In other words, they don't belong to political parties. You have independent 4,000 Sauga aligned or local government ward councillors. Are you suggesting that this multi-party fund must then have a formula that gives these 4,000 ward councillors some, because my understanding is you're saying the multi-party democracy fund must fund local government. It already funds political parties, so the ANC will get its share as the ANC, and so would the DA, and so would the organized, if I could call it for want of a better word, political parties. I'm trying to understand, what are you saying to us about the independence? Are you saying that we must find a way of sharing the whatever money is in this fund with each individual ward councillor, and how are we going to do that? Just from a pragmatic point of view, how do you anticipate that happening? Because I'm looking at the South Africans out there. They are saying that we want to know who's funding, we want to know what they're using it for, and I think the BLF just now was saying put a cap on it and all those type of things. And we know that many ward councillors are in today and are out tomorrow. We know that you're a ward councillor today, there's a by-elections tomorrow, you're out. Honourable South is talking about the capacity of accounting. If we get to that stage, and I say we, the Multi-Party Democracy Fund gives you as a ward councillor R1 million, do we really think that individual ward councillor has the capacity to account for it? Because currently we're saying political parties, and you are saying here the municipality, via the speaker and the municipal manager must account. But what we're saying in the Multi-Party Democracy Fund is that the individual political party must account, not the municipality. Not Parliament or the provincial government. Here, the political party that gets the money must account. The question that I'm asking, and I'm not making an argument for or against it, if that is extended to councillors, is it really practically accepted that a councillor, I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but I'm just asking the question, do we have the capacity as a councillor to account for all that money? These are the practical things that we must think about before we look at it. The final point that I wanted to make is that when you first raised the idea of wanting to come here, and I know that Janine, with her vote to count, or my vote counts, also raised it in court, we as the committee said that we are restricted by our mandate that talks about reviewing the current act that talks to local, I mean provincial and national and our time frames. But we also did indicate that this is a very important sphere and that we will go to the National Assembly and say to the National Assembly, beyond what we are doing now that must go to the House on the 30th, there is a real urgent need to look at the local government sphere. I think that was the general sense that we've got from our side. So I thought I'll put all these things on the table so that when you respond, you respond to all those things and assist us in taking the process forward. We certainly are not dismissing it. But there were these real practical constraints that we had seen initially. So if you could respond to all those, and then next week members of the committee will have to decide how we incorporate what has come from Salga. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, allow me to first sketch our understanding as local government. Is that why South Africa could be this unitary state? The impact of government should be at the local government. And the growing of democracy should be directed at local government. The development, therefore, of our communities become key in any state. And unfortunately, when you look at how most funding in this country is skewed and its assistance is skewed towards both provincial and national, if you go to a street, maybe in East London where I stay, you'll find that up the street there's a constituency office, which is about a provincial person. Down the street, there's a constituency office about the national person. But where do we see them? And how do they interface and assist the local government level? Those are the issues that maybe need some critical thinking. The question comes in as to talking about the cost. Precisely on the basis of cost, it needs some tighter scrutiny in terms of how then that funding could be managed. Our understanding is that whether you're a ward councillor, you don't have your ward fund as a separate issue which is in your fund. The way local government is structured councils is that the assistance of ward councillors is in the speaker's office currently, precisely because the speaker has the responsibility of public participation. Then on the basis of such, our view is that that then becomes the central office to deal with that kind of question. The issue of cost for me it escapes my thinking precisely on the basis that if everything would be about cost, there is a lot that should not be happening in South Africa today. And if the majority of our people which are in those wards would be seen as a big cost to actually deal with the constituency, I would have a problem as a person. I would have a problem in the sense that the democracy of South Africa is not matured, even for our own communities. And the issues that then are very critical for such are embedded in the responsibility of people who are closer to those people who are the ward councillors. This then brings to me an understanding of how our own constitution was created and crafted. That the constitution started to talk about both the national and and provincial. And it looks like it was the thing that was kind of forgotten to think there is also local government. And I'm thinking that sitting here was starting to bring back that thinking. knowing fully well that some issues that you're talking to might be issues that we want to redirect to other committees and see the need for them to be looked at. That then is accepted, Chair. But for me, I do not want to see the issue of cost about this, what that we're proposing, linked to the issues of ESCOM and the sources of funding in local government. Precisely because of how local government is structured and funding, which could go to how local government as a general issue is funded by South African government, that you would find that government relies on municipalities and communities to buy electricity for people who have never bought electricity, nor even have ever had that. But also the municipality must be suffering because of that. Why is the basis for revenue collection in some areas, how municipalities are working? And I do not believe that, therefore, I think there is honesty and sense in this thing that one of the issues that we should be looking at is how do we look at solving the funding problems of local government. I think I like this member who with the saying the issue of even what they earn should be an issue. I think I heard you correctly. And I it's the first time I'm hearing a person from this level sympathizing with what councillors are getting. And they are expected to stretch that to actually see to them saving their own communities from the same salary. It's not called a salary, it's called what? Allowance. Our what we get is called an allowance, which kind of, I would be shocked to say, you have a councillor that earns 5,000 rand a month, and it's expected to service a community. These are the reasons that we say you do not find that kind of work happening at that level. But then again, understanding that municipalities are about, the money they have is about service delivery. It's difficult to deal with the issues of dealing with constituencies at local level. It really depends. Hence, you'll find that there's always issues where a councillor will be accused to say, when last did you see you? The very councillor cannot even afford to go around the world because it's all dependent on the councillor's allowance. The issue that says why official opposition and not all, for me, I want to believe, could be an issue that starts to say in municipalities you'll find that this is what you call a chief whip or a one-line chief, whatever, what I get a chief whip, allow me to say that. You'll find that the chief whip has an office, but your official political party doesn't, because the municipality cannot afford more than what it does. Even with the chief whip, you'll find that there's not enough staff that actually gets them. We have political parties in local government that ideally would want to see them all having offices and staff, but it's not what the municipality can afford. Rightfully, from Mr. Selfie, that their money is about basic service delivery, not about empowering and enhancing this issue of e-land ordinary funding and party political funding. Why I was saying what councillors? For us, they are the basic structure that is very close and closest to the people. Can I leave the other questions for everybody to share?
Thanks, Honourable Chair, and thanks for the questions from the rest of the members of the committee. I will attempt to address each question. Firstly, we have made a detailed submission that attempts to address itself to specific clauses of the bill. Where we have not made a comment, we fully agree with the bill, particularly insofar as regulating the fund, the transparency, the principles that underpin the funding. We want to assume, Honourable Self, that this attempt is an attempt to put democracy of the Republic back in the hands of citizens. And therefore, there is no way that citizens can escape not to finance their democracy unless we create space for an elite capture of our democracy. From the local government point of view, I think it is important that particularly political parties operating at this level to note that if you look at the assumptions that we're making in the presentation that you have copies of, one of the issues that we're raising is that it may have been an oversight on the capitals of the constitution to omit local government. But at the same time, it may have been because the view at the time the constitution was crafted was that local is going to be local in the practical, physical sense. But with the consolidation of municipalities from 800 municipalities, over 800 municipalities then, and now you are sitting with municipalities that are actually bigger than many countries in the world that make a provision for political party funding, specifically because you would like your democracy for its legitimacy, but also for the vibrancy of political life to ensure that all citizens keenly follow what happens in the life of that country. We want to make the same argument as far as local government is concerned. I want to assume that honourable members are aware of this huge fiscus disaggregation model that our country uses insofar as the national fiscus. 201, with over 800 municipalities that we had in the country, only 1% of the fiscus went to the local sphere of government. So over 800 municipalities in the country had to divide the 1% of the national fiscus. Fast forward 17 years later to 2017, only 4% of the fiscus goes to local municipalities, excluding transfers, which in their nature are conditional grants and therefore out of scope for municipalities to decide on how to use them. And so if you were to look at that as one important variable that our honourable members must start looking at very closely, against a second variable which is very important, how geography as a political tool was used in the past, which has actually prefigured the plight of different municipalities that we have in the country. So not all municipalities would be in a position to afford to create mechanisms for whatever insignificant measure that are there to finance or to resource the interface between a municipality and its citizens. So the special inequities, in a way, are actually very telling, looking at the number of municipalities that are basically dependent on grants from the national sphere of government. The matter of ESCOM, I do want to suggest that maybe we should not get into that for obvious reasons, that it is a matter that we have substantively detailed as Salga. It is a matter that we have presented in various committees of the National Assembly and NCOP. It is a matter that we have taken a decision that we will take it for a constitutional review. So there is quite a number of issues that we would like to take up with ESCOM on many issues, including the so-called amount that municipalities claim, considering how the ESCOM has structured its tariffs and billing system. We do acknowledge that we have a crisis insofar as municipalities that owe ESCOM, but we think it is a matter that requires an attention that we have raised so significantly in many committees of the National Assembly. So if municipalities were then to focus on starting the basics, even then, and again, Chair, I am quite aware that that would be a discussion for another committee, with the fiscus that seems to be disadvantaging the local sphere, you still would have the national sphere having to come in and support municipalities insofar as them being able to do that. Some municipalities may, and that is purely on the basis of the structural advantages of our economy, based on the structural, the special inequities that we have been engaging the committees on. With respect to your questions, Honourable Chairperson, we want to assume that there are three categories that are important that the committee must apply its mind to, insofar as this matter is concerned. The first one is what councillors or wards in a municipality. The local system of government in South Africa has a mixed electoral system. It's got proportional representatives, and it's got what community representatives. Now, if we can, for a minute, apply our mind to that as is, then we would realize that the proposal we're making is practical, is possible to implement. What we're suggesting here is that the committee must extend funding to a municipality for wards, not for ward councillors. And that is why we are suggesting that the political principle that must preside over those matters must be the speaker. So regardless of who is a ward councillor, the speaker has full control of that fund, and that is why we say the municipal manager must be the accountable officer for that fund, and that the auditor general must be responsible for auditing those funds. So in other words, we want to assume that crafters of our legislation did not make a mistake when they made a provision that in local government there must be community representatives. We do want to acknowledge, though, that various political parties tend to support certain community representatives and campaign for those. But we want to leave that for political parties to deal with. Otherwise, insofar as we're concerned, these are community representatives. That is why we're proposing that the funding must be specifically meant for wards, not ward councillors. So regardless of who becomes a ward councillor today and who becomes a ward councillor tomorrow, there is a provision, or there should be a provision for funding for that ward for constituency work. However, there are community organizations that are committing even on the PR side of the elections, and that's why there's a provision for PR councillors. But what we're saying is, community organizations, but what we're saying is that where a community organization competes for elections, it must clearly declare whether it is a political party or it is a community organization limited to that municipality. In which case, if it is a political party, then it must actually be subjected to the very same provisions that all political parties are subjected to. If it is not and limits itself to a community organization, it would have then to be dependent on the management and control of the speaker. We're taking that further if you look at the presentation and the submission, that a community organization and a ward councillor will not be funded for political, advancing the political interest in a ward council. So their role will be limited to ensuring that we deepen democracy and they interact with everyone, not limited to whoever they so prefer insofar as political allegiance is concerned. And that is different to political parties, where we're saying the same provision as we've listed in the presentation should be applicable to political parties. However, if a community organization wants to migrate, it must do so, and when it does so, then it becomes subject to the full provisions of the bill as proposed, and we fully support the provisions of the bill. The link between political parties at a national and provincial level, as well as at a local government level, we want to argue, Honourable Chair, that we are in no position to say this is how the Democratic Alliance has performed in terms of how it works with these local structures. This is how the ANC has performed in terms of interface with these local structures. But evidence is there for everyone to see that it doesn't look like the funding that is available at the national and the provincial level yields positive results insofar as deepening democracy and ensuring that there is a substantive trust between municipalities and communities. And therefore, we are of the view that there should be funding specifically targeted at the local government level. And really, we would like to suggest that maybe at a political level that be tested. But at the same time, we are of the view that evidence is there to suggest that there is no benefit, positive benefits that are benefiting the local sphere insofar as the funds that are available for MPLs and the funds that are available for national MPs. With respect to the question that relates to funding of the official opposition, we are suggesting and certainly believe that it is open to discussion that there should be funding to enable a political party to run its constituency, to run its election campaign, to fund and recognize the official opposition. And lastly, we would like to draw the attention of the committee to prospects that if you were not to extend this benefit to the local sphere of government, that might introduce a new challenge insofar as the limited resources that are available at a local government level. One, if you are to prohibit direct funding to political parties and independent candidates through this legislation, you are basically closing the scale, the shop or any funding window for politicians at a local government level. If you are to prohibit funding by the state, you are basically saying municipalities, whatever ad hoc initiatives that they have, they should stop doing them, and that could have adverse effects insofar as the ability of local government to enable councillors to do conscious work. We want to believe that the implications of the Cape High Court order, that the local sphere of government must fully disclose, immediately imposes on the local sphere of government to ensure that there should be the same level and depth of accountability insofar as transparency, declaration, etc. So I wanted to make those brief additions. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, you have to apply your mind. It seems to me that we're going to have to distinguish between state responsibility and other, because what I'm hearing, especially from the last speaker, deepening of democracy, constituency offices and those type of things, that comes at a national and a provincial level, comes from Parliament, for instance, not from the multi-party democracy fund. There's never been an intention from this side of the House that the multi-party democracy fund is going to substitute what Parliament is doing currently. That was our understanding. So that's why I'm saying it might require that as provinces have the ability to ring-fence some of their budget for party purposes, similar type of mechanism will have to work at a local level. In other words, from your kitty, and I sympathize with the fact that you don't get too much, but I'm saying that's how it works at the provincial level. That's how it works at the national level. We get a kitty outside of this party funding that we're talking about. That kitty is used specifically for constituency offices, for MPs to be able to do it. It's different to the multi-party democracy fund. So this is going to need us to apply our mind somehow or the other, over and above the constitutional requirements you're talking about. So we'll have to see how we fit it in. I don't want to raise anybody's hopes I want to be frank and honest. I don't want to raise anybody's hopes that we're going to be able to address it in this piece of legislation, simply because of the mandate that we have. You know, I would hate a situation where you say that the chairperson or the committee made this undertaking and totally ignored it in the final product. The least I can do, or the committee can do, is to say it's a very serious matter. We have to ask Parliament to consider it, but I'd be less than frank if I said to you that we're going to address it in this piece of legislation and then for that to be my legacy going forward, that I made this undertaking and I never followed it. I don't want to do that, and I want the committee to sit with that legacy. I want to be upfront and frank. If it makes us unpopular, then so be it. But let's not go. This is too important a matter for us just to brush aside and say, we'll deal with it, and then we don't deal with it. So members will have to apply their minds in the next 2 weeks when we sit and look at it. How do we at least start the process? Because the issues being raised by local government are real. They are real, and they need to be incorporated. And the fact that they've taken time to come in and present and to put a case, I don't think we can just throw it into file 13. I don't think we can do that. Honourable Mulder, it seems like you want to say something. I'll allow all the members, because I'll allow all the members from Omruzu Komede up to Ntlantla if you want to say anything on this, and then we will see how we take it forward. But can we start with Honourable Komede if you have anything to say on this matter? 2 minutes or 3 minutes per person. If you don't, it's fine. Honourable Komede?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Honourable Chairperson, I think the fiscus, that is the government, should fund democracy. I think democracy at all levels. But as we stand here, we are looking at the provincial level and the national level. But in principle, I think there is no one that is against a staggered approach, that is, when we finish this, then we look at the local government with its peculiarities, with its complexities, because it is different. It has got independence, ward councillors, and so forth. So for that reason, I think we cannot consider it at this stage. But surely, it should be considered at a later stage. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honourable Mother?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. I think we hear what the colleagues are saying and understand the importance of what they are saying. Maybe at a different forum we should discuss the challenges of local government in terms of own revenue and all those kind of challenges, but that's a different debate. Our current mandate is derived from the Constitution in Section 236. So even if we try to address the concerns in this bill, it will make our bill unconstitutional. So I don't think that we can go further than in our report to mention this and ask the House to find a mechanism or to look into it at some stage. But at this stage, I believe we cannot address it in the current bill.
Honourable South.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'm substantially covered. I would endorse your request that a submission is made to the Constitutional Review Committee to look at Section 236 because I think although you do propose a two-stage approach to the adoption of this legislation, we are precluded from passing unconstitutional legislation. So, I mean, there's no way we can follow the two-stage process. But the correct way to deal with this thing is to approach the Constitutional Review Committee in relation to Section 236.
Honourable Mateus.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. And we are very sympathetic to what goes on the ground and with our ward councillors, and we do understand that the challenges that a lot of our ward councillors and PR councillors face on the ground. And as has been highlighted now, is that we are also just tied up constitutionally. So those are things that definitely do need to be reviewed. But what I do want to suggest is that Zaga comes up with a concrete plan on how do you see this thing working. For example, you're recommending that this funding be given to a speaker. Ultimately, a speaker can't account necessarily for the money, because if the money is going to a next level, for example, to a ward councillor, the ward councillor is going to have to account for it. Like, Treasury disperses money, for example, to a province, to Parliament, who disperses, to who's actually doing the constituency work. So you have to come up with that. And when you come and present, or at the next time when you're going to have the opportunity to see how you're going to push your agenda forward, have the plan. This is how you're going to work. The main thing South Africans want to know is that how is the money going to be accounted for? Is it going to be used how it's supposed to be used? Is everybody going to benefit from it? And how is everyone going to benefit from it? And I think everyone would be sympathetic to having that. But you have to sit and you know what happens on a local government, what's possible, what's not possible. We sit here and we say, oh yeah, it's possible. Each ward councillor, they must get this amount of money each quarter. You know what the challenges are. So come up with something practical and prepare it so when you have the opportunity to present it, you know, okay, this thing can work, and these are the areas I've covered. And I want to encourage you to do that, because we do know service delivery is exactly there at local government, and we need our councillors and staff to be on the ground and to be able to do that. So, and thank you so much for your presentation.
Honourable Mubeda.
Thanks, Chair. Though I came late, but I think the little that I had presented now, you know, it's made me to be more frustrated. And because if you remember, Chair, when we started, we had discussions in terms of whether local government must also be included or what. But in terms of what the mandate now that we are given as the committee, it was clear that local government is not going to be included. So I think, Chair, let me say I'm covered by my colleagues. Maybe, yeah, I'm covered for now.
I thank you very much, and I thank our colleagues from SALGA. We will continue to talk to you. You've heard what we've said, we've heard what you have said, and we will take it from there. I think members are sincere when they say it's a matter that is important that we must take forward. We'll just find the most impactful way of telling South Africans and Parliament that there's a need for this change. And as we've indicated, I do think that you must make a submission to the Constitutional Review Committee. It's going to be the gateway to many of your solutions. Thank you very much. On that note, I will allow you to leave if you want to leave, or you can go and sit and listen to the next. Can I appeal to members that we take the next one without any break, or do you need a two-minute break, members? No. Can we go directly on to, because advocate Pansila Kula is here to do a presentation. Can we go straight ahead? Yeah. Come over, ma'am, with your team, if there are any, and then we will hear from Information Regulator and Advocate Lakula will do the presentation.
It should be in your pack, the submission. It's number 16 in your pack, if you've got amended your pack. And it is a PowerPoint presentation as well. To make it easier, it should be a PowerPoint for the presentation, but the detail on the slide, or not slide, but number 16.
Thank you very much. Welcome very much, Advocate. You have been, and don't blame me or anybody in the committee, blame the boss. She has given you 15 minutes to do your presentation and given members 20 minutes. I don't know what rationale she used, quite honestly, neither do anybody here, but we rely on her wisdom. So you've got 15 minutes, but if you're going to go for 17 minutes or 16 and a half, we won't fight with you. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members of the Committee. We are delighted to be here, and we thank you for giving us this opportunity. Our presentation is straightforward and to the point, and it will not be long, and I'm sure I'll do it within the 15 minutes that you have allocated to us. I'm here with my colleague, a member of the Information Regulator, Advocate Lebogang Strom, who is designated as a member responsible for the Protection of Promotion of Access to Information Act, as is required by the law. As you know, Honorable Chairperson and members, the Information Regulator is established in terms of Section 39 of the Protection of Personal Information Act, and the regulator is mandated to exercise its powers and to perform its functions in accordance with the Protection of Personal Information Act, which we acronym as POPIA. And in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, known as PAIA. We welcome the draft political party funding bill, but we want to address ourselves to the impact of the bill on PAIA, on COPIA, and also on the recent Western Cape decision of my vote count. And maybe what I should say is to preface my presentation by saying that we are mindful of your mandate, of the mandate of this committee, but we thought that it was important for us to make this submission, and honorable members will then decide how you deal with the submission. And using your words, Chairperson, I hope it will not be put in file setting, that when you make your report to the National Assembly, you will also put our submission to be considered, because we think the issues that we are raising are quite fundamental. The application, sorry, I think I skipped. Yes, the application in the case that I have just referred to, being the My Vote Count case, was premised on the right of access to information in terms of Section 32(1) of the Constitution. And Section 32 of the Constitution entitles citizens to have access to information, and the court in that case said that information includes information on funding of political parties, and that such information is required for the electorate to be able to exercise their right to vote as articulated in sections 19, 1 and 3 of the Constitution, so that there's a link between section 32 of the Constitution and section 19, 1 and 3 of the Constitution. Section 32 of the Constitution envisages true holders of information, as the court said, the unqualified right of access to information in terms of section 32(1)(a) held by the state, and a qualified right of access to information held by another person in terms of 32(1)(b), which the latter is required for the exercise or protection of any right. And the court, as we know in that case, was of the view that political parties fall within the category of another person in terms of section 32(1)(b) of the Constitution. The court further held that section 32 and 19 must be read together in order to determine what the Constitution requires, and that the information about political party private funding is required for the exercise of an informed right to vote. And in the presentation, we also refer to the earlier case the court looked at, and the court held further that section 32(1) read with section 19 of the Constitution and sections 7(2) and 1(d) thereof require disclosure of information on political party private funding for the exercise and protection of the right to vote. I thought it was important for us to lay this as a basis for our submission, and we concur with the reasoning of the court in this case, particularly in regard to the interconnectedness between Section 32, Section 19, and Section 7(1) and 2 of the Constitution. And we know that the court identified some gaps in PAIA, and the court says that PAIA appears to have been drafted without having political parties in mind at all. Says that there are categories of persons outside the state for whom PAIA has failed to make express or any provision for. The regulator agrees with the court that section 32(1) read with section 19 of the Constitution and section 7(2) and 1(d) thereof require disclosure of information on political party private funding for the exercise and protection of the right to vote. However, and this is the crux of our submission, that we are of the strong view that in order for the electorate to exercise their right to vote and to make political choices, they require all information held by political parties, not only information relating to private funding, all information. And we also are of the view that our electoral system is such that the right to vote is exercised through political parties because we use the proportional representation system of parliament, of a representational system. So that is why we are of the view that PAIA should be amended, and it should go just beyond just a disclosure of political of party funding. We are of the view that PAIA must be amended to include political parties so that the electorate can request all information from political parties. Because at the moment, since PAIA does not cover political parties, if an electorate wants information about a political party, they can go to the political party. If the political party does not give them that information, they have no recourse. So that is why we feel that PAIA should be amended to cater for political parties. And we indicate the extent to which it has to be amended, as the court identified the deficiencies in PAIA and said that Section 18 and 53 of PAIA do not cater for proactive disclosure of information, but provides for disclosure of records on application. So our proposal is that this section should be amended to include proactive disclosure of information held by public and private bodies, including political parties, who must do so systematically and without an application. Furthermore, we propose that the right to information under PAIA, as the court said, is restricted to recorded information, and we are of the view that PAIA should be amended to make provision for access to unrecorded information, as the court indicated in the vote count case. The regulator agrees with the court that given these deficiencies, PAIA's mechanisms and processes are inherently limited. PAIA is therefore not in sync with Section 32 of the Constitution and limits the latter section and also Sections 19, 1 and 3 respectfully. So we say that PAIA, to the extent that it does not include political parties, is unconstitutional. We are saying that the My Vote Counts decision, in that case, the court looked at the issue beyond it, the issue before it, and the issue before it was disclosure of party funding, and the court could not go beyond that because that was the case before it. So we say now that we have this opportunity, let's open up this matter, let's amend PAIA, let's bring political parties under PAIA so that political parties can also function transparently and disclose all information to all of us as the electorate, so that when we want to choose the political party that we want to vote for, we should have the benefit of that information. So that's our substantive submission, which we are making fully aware of the mandate of the committee. But regarding the bill itself, we have no difficulties with it. We have, however, a challenge with a concern with Section 3.5 of the bill, which provides that any contributor contemplated in subsection 3A may request the commission not to disclose their identity or the amount of the contribution. And in giving our comment to this, we also borrow from the decision of the court in My Vote Counts. And in that case, the court, in relation to privacy, held that given the public nature of political parties and the fact that the private funds they receive has a distinctly public purpose, their rights, that is the rights of political parties to privacy, can be attenuated. The same principle must also apply, in our view, to donors. We therefore feel that Section 3.2 of the bill defeats the very purpose of the bill itself and also the purpose of the court judgment, insofar as it relates to the principles of accountability and transparency. And we therefore feel, we recommend that Section 33.2 of the bill should be deleted, should be omitted from the draft bill. And our second, and which is last submission on the bill, is really on Chapter 5, Section 15.2, which deals with enforcement, and it says that in order to monitor compliance with this Act or investigate a complaint, the Commission may request any person to disclose any relevant information. We just feel that this section is too broad. The mandate of the Electoral Commission should be limited. And in making our submission, we borrow from Section 15(2) of the bill, which provides, and I quote, if a complaint relating to the income and expenditure of a political party is lodged with the Commission, it must, if the accounting officer of the fund is of the view that there is a prima facie substance to the complaint, investigate the complaint. So in relation to Section 15(2), the regulator submits that given the legislative mandate of the Commission, its role in investigating complaints must be limited to the investigations of complaints relating to non-disclosure of income and expenditure. We therefore propose that Section 15(2) must be amended accordingly to make it consistent with Section 15(4). We just feel that we need to protect the IEC here, because their mandate is quite straightforward. You don't want them to be doing things that fall outside their mandate, because doing that might just affect the independent, impartial way in which they are supposed to run elections. So if they really have to have a role in this, the investigations must simply relate to non-disclosure of incoming expenditure. So that's our submission. Chairperson, let me see if I have not. Yes, I think I have completed. And thank you very much for the opportunity. We are ready, my colleague and I, to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I note Honorable Self. Just, and I'm sure it will be covered by Self, but just 2 points from me. I recognize Honorable Self. You know, we asked our legal team, well, let me start by saying we are aware that the ruling of the Western Cape High Court must be confirmed. Now, if we move from the assumption that it is confirmed, let's assume we move from that assumption that it is confirmed, are you then suggesting that our piece of legislation would 3-5 would automatically become unconstitutional, because we're saying any contributor contemplated may request not to disclose. So the question is, let's assume everything else is confirmed. Does this make this one unconstitutional? Because for me, that's the primary. I don't want a piece of legislation that will be challenged. I'm premising it on the confirmation from the Western Cape High Court and the Constitutional Court. Does that close that gap for us? And if it does, then we must take advice on it. We asked our own legal team earlier on, and I think they suggested to us that in terms of your first one, PAEA must deal with PAEA. It's really, we can continue our own business on this side. And I think you're saying the same thing, because you're talking about the PAEA Act. So is our constitution, is our piece of work on firm ground? Is the first question that we're asking. And the second one that I want to ask, again from a practical point of view, our idea of a threshold, in other words, we've said that the IEC will have all the information. What we are saying is that below the threshold should not be automatic disclosure. In other words, the IEC would know that membership fees from the ANC is R1 million, Kong, whatever. But they don't have to go and put Vincent put R10, John put R5, and so on. So it's not as if it's not there. And the question I'm asking, would that satisfy you? And we're only doing it because, you know, if we said that the IEC must automatically disclose every contribution, we would have a nightmare in terms of them having to disclose the R5 that Matthijs gave, the R2 that Vincent gave. So it was purely from a practical point of view, the threshold. That was our intention, that it was a more practical than withholding information from South Africans or the public generally, because it will be with the IEC. So those are the two comments that I wanted to make that you would respond to. But then let's take Honorable Sal and anybody else that would want to comment, and we'll hand over to the team if there aren't any. Honorable Sal.
Thank you very much indeed. Chair, I have one question of clarity to begin with, because in both in the submission that you made and in your oral presentation, you referred to section 3.2 of the bill that needs to be deleted. I'm assuming you mean 3.5. Okay. Then, may I come back to the comments about PIA? Because I just want to, in much the same way that the chairperson articulated it, I want to understand where our responsibility in terms of this bill stops in terms of the court judgment. And as I read the submission that was made here, what you are asking is that we should not only disclose funding information, but, as you put it, all information. Now, I just want an understanding about what all information is. In other words, let's take, for example, we've got membership records, for example. Is it obligatory to give membership records? Because maybe people don't want to know, other people to know, that they're members of a particular political party. We've got canvassing information. Is it all right for me to say that Advocate Tlakula indicated that she was going to be supporting the DA? Where does it stop, in other words? And taken to its logical conclusion, I would have thought that if this was correct, one could legitimately say that a meeting of the cabinet, it falls within the purview of PIA, because that is a meeting of a political party. Okay, it happens to be in government, but it's still a meeting of a political party. It takes decisions that have an effect on an election. The public have a right to know on what's going on there. Where does it stop? I can still understand the logic that where you want to stop the harm of allowing a particular family to capture a political party by donations. But I don't know whether the public has a right to all the information held by a political party. And if it does have the right to all that information, on what basis does it have that right?
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm partially covered. It's just important to speak to what extent are political parties that we need to disclose information. I mean, there's operational information. My understanding in terms of the judgment that we received with the by-votes count, it was specifically talking to funding. So anything relating to funding in particular would need to be addressed. So, for example, what operations we are doing in terms of by-elections. So we need to just be clear, because if we make an open-ended, we can end up in the Constitutional Court. So we need your guidance on that, like when you going to do your amendments to your bill, is it going to be in as far as funding and what would stem out and to what extent the information is. And then also just to speak more on the impact of it. We had a long discussion about this on the impact of the My Vote Counts on what we need to do here in terms of the billing. So we figured that that's your thing to do, and we pretty much just need to know from you when are we overstepping the line. So we also need to have in sync our bill is in sync with you. So what do we need to include in our bill to make sure that we are not contradicting what needs to happen on your side? Thank you.
Can we head over? Yes? Honourable Committee.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Advocate Tlakula, for the presentation. Perhaps I think the whole exercise here is to empower democracy, empower democracy for all, and to empower democracy for parties with poor membership as well. And and government funding perhaps is the way to go, where government should totally fund political parties for their existence. But we also know that is not possible. And we also know that funding by private persons or private organizations is very difficult in some instances if all information is going to be disclosed. And shouldn't we then go for regulated disclosure? And then if so, do we have any model for regulated disclosure anyway? Because we have a constitution that would be more suitable for a social democratic party somewhere in Sweden and around Denmark and so forth. Those people can afford. Their members can afford. Their per capita income is many times the per capita income of a South African voter voting for the ANC, voting for the EFF, and perhaps for the DA as well. So if we then virtually remove private funding, how do we then fund political parties? Because right now, I am sure the government is not going to be in a position to increase funding. It is not going to, and then the funding is not sufficient to promote democracy. What do we do whilst we are seeking for a solution? Thank you, Chairperson.
Over to you, ma'am, and your team.
Thank you, Chairperson, and members for the questions. I think I made a mistake in presentation. We're talking about Section 35, not 32. For us, we have the view that if we are to promote openness and transparency, if you have that section, it negates the very essence of the bill, because all the donors will come and tell the IEC, please, we don't want our identity to be disclosed, we want to be confidential. So what will be the point? If the essence of this bill is promotion of transparency, then we have a problem with that clause. And if my vote will count is confirmed, surely that clause will not withstand constitutional muster. Well, if the Constitutional Court confirms that decision and the bill is passed as is, the following day you are in court. We live in a very litigious country, and the constitutionality of that will be challenged. So our view is that instead of going that route, let's rather deal with the challenges that we have and fix it now to avoid the possibility of litigation. That's what we are saying. Honorable Gumede, we are not saying that private funding should not be allowed. That's not our point. Our point was really on non-disclosure. Maybe you misunderstood me. Our main point is that if we live in a constitutional democracy where we must all strive for openness, and that we exercise our right to vote in this country through political parties, and that is the system that we have chosen. So political parties in this country are very central to our democracy. Therefore, our view is that if we depart from that premise, we should put them within the ambit of PAIA, so that when we talk about bodies in PAIA, we talk about private and public bodies, and we define private to include political parties. And your question, Honorable Self, where do we draw the line? There's international jurisprudence on what becomes exceptions to non-disclosure. So, for instance, there's information that may not be disclosed, and that will also be mirrored by what the protection of personal information says, because you have another safeguard there. In any case, if you look at the Protection of Personal Information Act, it brings in political parties as an exception because it says you cannot process political information on political persuasion. But it says institutions that are of a political nature can do that, which means political parties can process personal information of their members regarding their political persuasion. So POPIA already brings in political parties within the fold of the ambit of the Act. So, for instance, how far do you go? I may ask information from a political party. Can you give me information on your constitution? Can I have information on what processes do you have in place to elect your executive? I want to know internally what is the internal democracy processes that you have. I may want to know those kind of information about how the party functions, its constitution, election of its bearers, if it conducts its primaries, if we can call it that way, we can use that word, if it conducts primaries or elections internally, what are the processes? We don't know. Unless you are a member of a political party, you can know that. But sitting where I am, I don't know what are the processes that are used for that. So there is information that I think should be made available by political parties to the electorate proactively, so that if that information is not there, the electorate can also come to you to say, can I have information about this? Can I have information about that? At the moment, you can't do that. And if I can be bold, Chairperson, I can even say that at the moment, there are a lot of court challenges, and I'm not really, please bear with me, I'm just trying to give an example, I'm not entering the political arena, but what happens at the moment is that within political parties we are beginning to see an emergence of members challenging each other in court. You know, if you bring PAIA, political parties into PAIA, you may actually even address those problems, because a party can come and say, give me reasons why this has happened, why this decision has been taken, and that party can then go through the internal processes of the party and exhaust the internal processes of the party. Once they've done that and they have not received any joy, then in terms of PAIA, they can then lodge a complaint with the information regulator, which information regulator will investigate that complaint and can issue an enforcement notice. You know, so there are advantages even for political parties for bringing political parties under PAIA, and we make that point quite strongly, and this is the only opportunity that we have.
Thank you, Chairperson. Adding on what my Chairperson has just said now, your point on whether if PAIA is amended, whether it will affect your Section 3.3.3.5 of your bill, definitely so. It will definitely affect it, because if you look at the reasoning of the court case in relation to Section 35, the judge mentioned that 35 is to give effect to the right to access information, which then provides for legislation to be enacted to give effect to 32, and that is that legislation is PAIA. So, I mean, given that reasoning from the judge, it's not the order, the reasoning, you can see that once it's been amended, definitely you'll have your, it will render your Section 35 unconstitutional.
All right. In layman's language, I'll come back to you with this. I mean, in layman's language, your comment or your advice to us is that they can, and we're assuming that it's confirmed, your advice to us is that there can be no justification, whether through this legislation or other legislation, to withhold information, even on the request of the donor. So even if somebody said to us, I don't want my name to be known, and I'm saying, and let's look at the rationale, and we're not arguing with you. You know, when we put that in there, members will recall, at the time we said, sometimes they are just human beings that don't want to be out there in your face to go and say, I donated, especially to the multi-party democracy fund, especially to that fund, not to political parties. I just don't want to brag, for want of a better word. I'm doing it, and I want to do it quietly, and then would be able to say, look, I'm doing it, but I really don't want my name to be out there. And it was in that thinking that we put this there. And there was also this other argument that was raised earlier on that there might be intimidation, and all these arguments were raised. I'm saying, having raised all those arguments, court came and it made a judgment in favor of my vote count. Gets confirmed, let's assume it gets confirmed. You're then saying, if that is the scenario, even if Vincent says, you know, my faith doesn't allow me to make it public, then it means that Central Fund or the ANC or anybody cannot accept that funding. That's what you're saying to us, isn't it? If that's what you're saying to us, then say it so that we are able to deal with it, and we don't have to put something here that is going to open up a door that is problematic for somebody. Let me repeat what I'm saying. If Vincent Smith feels, rightly so, nothing wrong, I just don't want my name out there for having donated either to the Central Fund or directly to a political party, and I make that request specifically. If the Central Fund accepts it, it means that there will be conflict with the law. If a political party accepts it on my conditions, it means there will be conflict with the law. We're trying to understand it as basically as that, because if that's what it is, then we must not even open the door for it in our act. That's what we want to understand. As simple, I don't know, other than Mulder, I don't think many of us are lawyers here, so if you could make it as simple as that to us. Did you want to say something, Matthijs, around this matter, and then we'll give them the last bite? Or, in fact, any other member that wants to raise, you could raise it, and then the advocates will have a last chance. Anybody wants to have a second bite?
Okay, thank you, Chair. Yeah, so I'm covered on that issue. Just on the issue on the access of information to political parties, right, outside of what affects funding, both private and public funding. So you gave examples of processes, our constitution, how we elect leadership, etc. I don't know any political party who doesn't have that information available. Websites and how those things work, right? I mean, the fact that some political parties are even taken to court means that those systems are in place. And my only concern on this is not having making that information available on how we elect leaders, how often we have, because this does affect people joining our parties. It also affects who's going to vote for us, because they want to make sure that there is democracy within a political party and how a political party operates. So that's not an issue. But I want you to give or give some guidance, or what's your take on to what extent, because one day we might get a request, for example, we want the minutes of the meeting of the officials for this particular date. Are we going that far? We just want the basic operation. So, because those things can go to the Concord, and then one day it's like, okay, every minute for every meeting you've had, even when you met with your branches, must be made available. It just becomes very consuming for a political party to be able to manage a huge amount of decisions that it makes countrywide. So I'd just like you to speak to that, like, you know, give us some guidance. Thank you.
Okay, over to you, Yuchi.
Everything that applies in PAIA, I mean, private bodies and public bodies are required in terms of PAIA to disclose information on request and proactively, you know. And we are saying PAIA should apply to political parties. We don't understand why PAIA cannot apply to political parties. There is nothing that political parties want to hide, I'm sure. Let us put it out there in the open, even those minutes, because in PAIA, in terms of PAIA, you can go and request anything from, I mean, within the bounds of the law, from a public body, you know, from a private body, if you want to exercise or protect your rights, the limited scope. But we say because of the place that political parties occupy in South Africa, and I'm being specific, because we elect our leaders through political parties. So privacy should trump really access insofar as political parties are concerned. That's the submission that we are making. And we are saying even donors, therefore, if they want to donate to political parties, they then have to know that their privacy is trumped, and that is what even the court said in my vote count case. That it's just as simple as that. And we are taking we are saying this as a body that is now going to take the promotion of access to information enforcement. It's going to come to us from the South African Human Rights Commission. And we are saying that we are 22 years into our democracy. What is it that we can do better? And how can we lead? And we will be leading to say that let's subject our political parties to transparency and openness as we require it from everybody else, not only insofar as party funding is concerned. That's our submission, Chairperson.
I know, it got clear. It got clear, it's very clear. Whether we agree or disagree with it is a different matter, but what they're saying to us is very clear. It's then up to us to take the risk if we think that we disagree with them, or to toe the line if we think we agree with them. But they're very adamant in what they are saying. I don't know how it affects the rest of us, but they are adamant. It's only last the word that Honorable Mulder.
So now we have to take information regulated to court as well. No, that's just the light of vein. No, thank you, Chairperson. It's quite clear what is being said. And I think this is not the last. I think this will still be argued in court in future, but let's see where it goes. Like, I think that parties will say my election strategy should not be public knowledge, and that's a different debate. We'll get there.
Debate, because PAIA also puts exceptions to what information can be made available, commercial secrets and so on. You can't find, and the same principles through UGM will apply to political parties. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Interesting discussions. We'll have to take decisions next week. Honourable Member, thank you, Advocate Kitakula and your colleague there, Professor Dirk Kotze and Ms. Zed Khadebe, are they around? They are representatives of UNISA. They're going to come to talk to us. And it's your presentation number 3. And there's a PowerPoint presentation as well. And Prof and Ms. Khadebe, we've given you 20 minutes. And members will then take 20 minutes to engage your presentation. And there is always going to be tea and whatever available, but those that do enjoy tea and refreshments, please do so in a manner that doesn't unduly disturb the proceedings of this meeting. I'm assuming members have got the presentation, the executive summary, plus the detailed one that has been presented. Prof. Kotze and Ms. Khadebe, thank you very much for one, doing the presentation and making time to do that to assist us. And secondly, thank you very much for also affording us the opportunity to benefit from your own wisdom face to face, as we're going to do in the next 20 minutes. Can I hand over to you, sir, and your team? And at 12 o'clock, we'll start looking at you in a funny way, and that would mean that your time is about to expire.
Thanks very much, Honourable Chair. We are here on behalf of our department at TUNISA of Political Sciences. As you say, we have submitted two documents. It's the first, the comments, and then the presentation. And I want to concentrate on the presentation part of it, because the comments are, some of them are quite detailed about the text, and some amendments that we propose or changes to the text, and so it's not always necessary to talk about all of that. I think as our point of departure, we understand the bill as consisting actually of two elements. The one is the two funds, and that's the party funding part of it, and the second one is the private donations part of it. And that the second part, which is the private donations, in our view are not necessarily limited by Section 236 of the Constitution. So it does not necessarily only apply to represented parties at national and provincial level. And you will see also from our comments that makes that assumption. And therefore, we want to highlight a few specific aspects. The first one is the notion of, or the concept of, political parties as they are used in the bill in general. On the one hand is the represented political parties, you know, as they are defined in the current 1997 Act. And with that, we, given the discussion about local government, I mean, we have similar sort of observations about the limitations of that, but for the moment we understand that's your mandate. But with respect to the private donations, we think the definition of political parties as they appear in Chapter 3 of the bill is not useful, because it uses the definition of the Electoral Commission Act, Section 1, and then later on Section 15 is also used. And the Section 1, although it is already in the Act, and it's understandable why you sort of use the Act as the definition, in our view, that definition is quite tautological, because it defines a political party in terms of a political party. And that doesn't really sort of include all the aspects of a political party that we think should be included in such a definition. So what we want to propose is that the definition is already, whether it's this one or even other legislation, is already implemented by the IEC. When political parties register with the IEC, that list of political parties are available on the website of the IEC, so it's public knowledge. And in a sense, what political parties have done, that they've defined themselves already as political parties who want to be in the domain of political parties. So it's not necessary for an act like this one, therefore, to define political parties again. In a sense, they've done that. So this is already the IEC's registration is already an implementation of a specific act and different legislation. And therefore, it's the onus is not anymore on the institution who wants to implement this act to define which is a political party and which not. Because I think it can become an issue of which institutions or entities or bodies are subject to this legislation and which not, which must declare, for example, what is their personal or private income in the form of donations or not. So therefore, we want to propose that we say political parties, an entity registered as a political party with the Electoral Commission in terms of the Electoral Commission Act and stop there. Because in our view, that will then include all the aspects. What it does mean, it also includes political parties that are not necessarily yet participating in elections. And I think it's a bit of a narrow approach to only look at political parties who have already participated in elections. That means therefore registered, represented political parties. Because there can be parties in the pipeline who can accumulate money over time and just before a general or provincial election then register for the first time for the election. And then all the money has accumulated, but they don't have to disclose it. Only once they have registered, qualify as a represented political party, then they start to have to disclose it. So we want to broaden the definition, therefore, of political parties to political parties who might be in the pipeline to participate in elections. Now, another point which is related to political parties as it, and the concept which is being used, or the phrase that's been used in the bill, is about members of political parties. It says, for example, that in clause or section 8 about donations, point A, on clause 9, 3, 11 in the heading, that it refers to members of political parties. But we all know that political parties have normally many members, 500,000, 800,000, 1.2 million. So the question is, how will it be possible for party management, party leadership, to manage what happens with each and every member of that party in terms of receiving donations? It's impossible. It's practically impossible to do it. So what we would rather therefore say is that instead of reference to members of political parties, we would say that it is an elected public representative like you here, or at whatever, in whichever sphere of government, provincial or local, any party official, that means persons who have been elected the leader, the federal chairperson, or whatever the persons are called, a party official, therefore, or an appointed employee. That means someone who is working for the party in the head office or whatever party office of that. That those people, those persons, must be those who become subject to this legislation. That if some money, if they receive some money, or if they have done something in the name of the party, then they certainly, we assume, they have a mandate of the party. But if one person in Beaufort West, who happens to be a member of the party and receives some money, you in your party offices won't know about it. So how can you therefore sort of include that person in this legislation in terms of this whole disclosure, especially the disclosure procedures? Now, something which has up to now hasn't been referred to, and you will see our presentation is more on the side of the public disclosure and the private donations than about the public funds, the public funding part of it, is that the focus is on political parties. But we know that there are many other bodies that are often aligned to political parties, what you can call proxies, can call those of associated with political parties, like trusts, for example, like foundations. We know about all these German foundations who are directly linked to political parties. We can talk about investment or other forms of companies. You all know about them that exist in South Africa already. We know even about the trade unions who have their own investment companies, but obviously they are not included in this legislation. Even NGOs can be used as very closely aligned to political parties. Now the question is that we want to put on the table here, what about them? What about private donations given to them? Because it's very easy that political parties, while they are confined or limited in terms of the private donations that they receive in terms of the public disclosure that's proposed here, can start to look for alternatives. And we want to propose that gap, because it is a gap in our old Zubo, that should also be addressed. But because otherwise, the focus is merely going to move into other directions. And what it is even possible, which is not in our documentation, is that because local government elections and local government parties are at this point excluded in terms of the 236 also, means that national and provincial parties can start to align them to local parties. And then the funding can go to local parties, but actually it is given for the national or the provincial parties. So there are certainly quite a number of loopholes or gaps which I think should be addressed. Therefore, our proposal, in addition to the broader definition of a political party, we also want to propose that it should also include entities financially associated with political parties, which should then be seen in combination with political parties. Another area which is not addressed in the bill is party-to-party funding. We all know about, and it's not confined to South Africa, of where one party outside the country gives funding to a party inside the country. Now, in terms of the definition in the bill of foreign governments, foreign government agencies, or foreign persons, which are all excluded from giving legal donations, this aspect is not included. And I think it is important because it depends on what is the logic of the legislation. Is it about trying to make sure that there's no external interference in the domestic politics of a country like South Africa? If that is the logic, then I would argue, or we would argue, that this aspect must be included. Because then a party can simply become a substitute for a government. And in many cases, that is the case. Now, one aspect which the former chairperson and CEO of the IEC started to raise is about the role that the IEC plays in this legislation or the proposed in the bill. First of all, the IEC's responsibilities are set out in Section 5 of the Electoral Commission Act. All of them deal with electoral matters. Now, the fact that the IEC is already managing the Representative Political Parties Funding Act 1997 is already, I think, used as a precedent to say, well, let's extend it to include the IEC also and give these other responsibilities to the IEC also. However, from our side, and it's more from not a legal but a political science point of view, I think we want to caution against it, that the powers and the responsibilities given to the IEC in this bill deals with internal financial party matters. They don't deal with electoral matters in the first instance. Ultimately, it might have implications for electoral matters, but not as they are presented here. Because as it is presented here, it makes the IEC primarily responsible to manage all aspects of the regulation or management of the private donations and the disclosure of them. And I think we think it has the opportunity to create disputes between the IEC and specific political parties. Because, for example, it is about when the IEC must decide to discontinue the payment from the two funds. Or when there must be a repayment by the political party after an election, if they haven't been elected again, and what that amount of money will be. Or whether the regulations must be issued to political parties when the understanding there has been misappropriation of the funds, not in accordance with this act. Now, if you take all of those together, there's huge opportunity for disputes between the political party and the IEC to say, but you are biased towards us. We all know about the Tlokwe situation where this issue of the independence of the RAC came to the fore as an issue. And I think we all want to protect the RAC's good work that they have done over the years, the independence of them, their credibility, and not sort of give them now tasks that run the risk that their credibility or reputation can be damaged because they become involved in internal political matters which are essentially not their responsibility. So what we propose here is two options at least. The first one is that many of these aspects are actually judicial in nature. It is about taking a decision that must be implemented. It's based on an implementation of the act. And what we are saying is that, that the electoral court will possibly be in a better position, they have their status as a high court, to be able to take that judicial decision, issue that judicial order, and then it can be for the IEC to implement that order. But they didn't take that decision in the first instance. So they don't take responsibility for making that choice or that decision. Or alternatively, as a second option, is that another management body for private donations should be established because the Electoral Act has already some tasks to fulfill as they are described in this legislation. But we want to have two options. In general about the role of or the prescriptions with regard to disclosure, the way in which we understand this legislation is that it is, in a sense, it almost started with the 2005 Idasa court case, the judgment then, and subsequent to that, where there was not yet, although there was some development with respect to public funding, there was very little done with respect to the disclosure of private funding. Now, this element here, I think the way in which we understand this legislation is that it is the first step in terms of public disclosure of private funding, private donations. Now, the way in which it is presented here is that the onus is to a large extent on parties to perform the auditing, then it is reported to the IEC, then the Auditor General can audit if they want to, but it creates the impression that it becomes, in a sense, watered down. So in terms of similar approaches, for example, by the Council of Europe, and I have some of the documentations here, they propose the idea that there must be a separate independent auditing body that takes responsibility for this, for the auditing part. And I think this is something which we want to present to you as an option. The last part that we want to address is the funding of elections. Now, in this bill, very little is said of electoral funding. Now, there's one part mainly about after an election, about the report that must be done, especially when there is first 1 month and then 12 months and so on, which is slightly confusing, but that's not our main point. In the current Act of 1997, in Section 9.3, it says that party accounts that were established to deal with the public funding from Parliament, that must be closed 21 days before the election. So it creates the impression that money must not be used during the election time itself. That is not included in this bill. So that sentiment, there might be a good reason for that, but it is not here. So it suggests that this money from either the two funds or the public, the private donations, can therefore be used for election purposes. But it's not explained, it's not set out in what sense it could be used. Now there are, I would say, at least two to three different options or approaches for financing in very broad terms that are possible. The one that has been used, referred to earlier on, and that is that is that of the maximum total expenditure, electoral expenditure per party, irrespective of their representation. So whether they are a governing party or opposition party or small party, there's a certain maximum. And your question, I think, that you posed about whether it's a small party or big party or just one board candidate, I mean, that's something that's the practical elements that must be sorted out in this. I can immediately see that certain categories can be created for that. But that's one option in addition to what has been already included in this in this bill. The second one, which hasn't been referred to yet, is a ceiling in terms of private electoral donations. So that donations are disclosed, but that there must be also a maximum of that donations per entity. And then in all respects, I think what is an element that runs across all of these options is that no foreign funding is included. So foreign funding are excluded in all respects. I think one of the points which, from our point of view, is absent in the bill is that there are all these measures of public disclosure of private funding, but it is mainly before the election. Well, I think what is of public interest will be is also to see after the election reporting of all that money that parties have received, how they were actually used. And lastly, I think what is important is, and we had now this previous discussion about the judgment of the Marvel Trump's judgment, the way in which I treat it, not as a lawyer, I'm not a legal expert, is that the emphasis is very much on independent ward councillors. Now, it looks like, given the way in which the bill is presented here, as if it is, and if it is correct to interpret it that it does not only include represented political parties, but parties in general, then it looks possible to already include, for example, independent ward councillors and their disclosure of public fund or private funding in the form of donations to be included in this. But that is something which is a new dimension, which you know we simply mentioned, but it is not something which is an important part of our comments. So, Chair, I would stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Any additions, Matt? No. Thank you very much. We'll open it up to members. Let me immediately start, Prof. and Ma'am Khatebe, by being absolutely clear on this point. We are under no illusion that this piece of legislation is not the panacea to all our problems. It can never be the panacea to all our problems. Some of the issues you raised, I'll allow members, but I will certainly raise them, because I don't think our intention was, or our expectation was, that when we're done with this, that there will be no more problems or potential for problems. I think this is the first step towards that. So I thought, let me just make that as a overall view, but I think your input was very informative. I've got a few questions, but let me turn the tables and allow members to ask first, and then I'll come in if they've not covered it. I note Honourable Sal. Anybody else that want to raise issues? Followed by Nube Ndaba. All right, so let's start with Honourable Sal.
Thank you very much indeed, Chair. I just wanted to ask for clarity around party-to-party private donations by page 2 of the presentation. That, as I understand it, is dealt with in 9.3 of the bill. So, as I understand it, one can receive donations on a party-to-party basis, provided it's used for the purposes described in the bill, and only for those purposes, because that's effectively what happens at the moment. I mean, many foreign donors, foundations do work in this area. And the question that I have is, do you have a principled objection to that sort of role being performed by foreign sister parties, or is the objection that you don't want foreign parties to own South African parties to be a sort of fundamental issue of principle? Thank you.
Honourable Santa?
Well, I want to say, because I guess it's the same concern like what Honourable Santa has raised.
All right, let me raise a few of mine. And I'm trying to find the place where you're talking. Let's start with the ones that I have that are very clear. You know, you at some point said that our insistence that members of political parties should not be allowed to receive donations is something that you don't understand or that's problematic. Let me give you the rationale about it. And you said it should only be left to represented political parties, if I understand what you're saying. Now let me give you an example. Party A is about to go to a conference. And Vincent Smith is not a public representative. Somebody comes to Vincent Smith and says, we're going to give you R1 million so that you can go and campaign to become the president of the country, of the party. And after being the president of the party, you are captured by me. Practically, that's what happens. And that's why we're saying money should go to the party and not to the individual. So I'm saying I'm differing with you, and you must explain why my thinking is maybe outdated. The second one, you talk about the caps, I think it's our fault. We did indicate on Friday that is going to appear in our regulation. So we will do it's not in the principle or in the principal act, but our regulations will talk about the upper cap. So that will happen, sir. And then, of course, you came with this option that says that we must not do things that would make the IEC or put them into conflict. I thought, and you need to tell us where you think we're doing that, because we were very clear that all the decisions will be taken at the electoral court level. The IEC would come and say, we've got prima facie evidence that party A has done X, Y, and Z. That will be subjected to the electoral court adjudication and decision. And then they will then exercise the sanction of withholding your fees or something like that. And if somewhere we've not made it very specific, then indicate that to us. But that certainly was the principle, that it's not going to be a decision of the IEC, but the electoral court that will take that decision. Then I don't understand when you say, well, let me put it to you how we understand it. We are saying that political parties have a responsibility to submit information to the IEC. And therefore that information must be credible information, it must be audited. Information that goes from the political party to the IEC. The Auditor General, when it's at the IEC, will do his own audit. I am understanding you to be saying that you want another audit entity to do something. Please explain what that something is, because the IEC is an institution of the state and the Auditor General is the supreme audit agency. Are you saying the IEC must be audited by another body outside of the Auditor General, or are you saying we should have an entity that would audit all the political parties in this country? And if that's what you're saying, you need to indicate who's going to do that and who's going to fund it, if that's what I understood you to be saying. And then you spoke about something about parties not yet registered. I didn't quite get it, I just made a note, but you spoke about parties not yet registered. We had spoken at length about this matter, and we said for ease of implementation, we're talking about represented political parties. that we are covering in this thing. And we understand that, of course, there will be many budding political parties, but it's just practically impossible for us to be able to do the monitoring of parties not yet registered. Because I can tell you, where I come from in Westbury, there's probably a million individuals that think they can open a political party tomorrow. And would probably go and raise these funds correctly, so or otherwise. There's just no way that you'll be able to keep track of a institution that is not yet registered and think that you are going to subject it to what we are asking here, disclosure, accountability, and all those type of things. Because Honorable Self will tell you that it is not uncommon for a man and his fax machine to think that it's a political party. So how do we do that? I'm saying, if I've understood you correctly. So it was those things that I was talking about, and if you can point those things to us, we are able to amend or to change the act accordingly. So I thought I'd just raise those matters as matters that if you can pinpoint them to us in terms of this is the clause, members will then highlight them and we'll argue them when they come. But thank you very much. Like I said, this was very informative. It's not every day that we engage with professors of politics, but thank you very much, sir. So over to you to respond, and we'll go for a second bite if there's a need for a second bite. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Maybe I didn't present it good enough in the first instance, so I'm going to try again. First, with respect to the party-to-party situation, the 9.3 is not about parties, as I understand it. It says nothing in subsection 1b prevents a political party or member of a political party from accepting a donation from a foreign entity, which proposes it must be a foreign person, for the purpose of. So it doesn't talk about political, and in the definition of foreign persons, there's no reference to political parties. So if, please excuse me if I use now examples. We know that, of course it's in the public domain, that the Communist Party of China has donated money to South African political parties. We know British political parties have donated money to South African political parties. That's what I'm talking about. Not about Konrad Adenauer or the Ebrard Stiftung, one of those German Stiftungs, who give money for some activities or writing of publications or having workshops or those type of things. It's direct. Because what we are saying is those parties, in some instances, are governing parties. But they give money in the name of the political party to the South African political party. So in that sense, we are saying those are not, and it doesn't have to be governing parties, it can be just other prominent parties in other parts of the world. If the logic is that we want, that this legislation wants to prevent any form of sort of external presence, especially during election time, in the South African situation. That is why we make this proposal here. Your point, Chair, about why the reference to members. Yes, in Section 11, or the prohibition of donations to members of political parties, I think that addresses what you are saying. So we are not specifically referring to that as representative of the problem we are talking about. But if you look, for example, at 9.3 that I've just mentioned earlier on, it refers there to members of parties as if they are representatives of political parties. They receive money in the name of the political party. And the same also under the definition of donation on page 13 at the top, number 8 says, includes a donation in kind and a donation made to a member of a political party, and then it continues. So that's not presented in the negative context of what you are referring to, but rather as someone who accepts or receives money on behalf of a political party. What we are saying, it becomes exceptionally difficult for a political party or the leadership of a political party to be able to account for all of that. Because any of us can be a member of a political party and someone comes and gives you money and the rest of the party doesn't know about it. And how will that be disclosed if they don't know about it? So that's the point we want, and why we propose this alternative formulation to say the persons for whom the party must take responsibility or the donations for which they can account is those received by persons who are under the authority of the party. And that's basically the point we want to make with that respect. With respect to the IEC, and why we are arguing that the IEC might become sort of pulled into situations which over time can undermine their sense of credibility or of their reputation in general, is mainly Chapter 5, which is about the enforcement. And as I've read it, and I concede I'm not a legal expert, but I don't see any reference to decision-making by the Electoral Court, and that it is the IEC who implements the Electoral Court decisions. There's only a reference to when there's an appeal. Then the appeal is to the Electoral Court. But it is not that the Electoral Court takes in the first instance, the decision, and that the IEC, because if you look at Section 15, it's about inspection, monitoring and inspection powers. Then 16 is about the Commission's power to issue directions. And it includes, for example, under subsection 2, the direction must indicate the following sanctions. So it's a decision about, in a sense, almost a punitive measure, which includes suspension of payment of allocated money, the recovery of money that's irregularly accepted, imposition of administrative fine. I don't think it's the responsibility of within the ambit of the IEC to determine fines for parties, for example, or the cancellation of their registration as a political party. That can be done in the context of elections, but I'm not sure it must be done in terms of funding. The power to suspend payment of money, Section 17, I think it can become hugely contentious if the IEC decides that the money coming from the two funds will be suspended, that the party doesn't receive that money anymore. And you all know, it goes into the millions of rands. The power to recover money regularly accepted or spent means, in a sense also, it requires a judicial decision whether that money that was spent, whether that was received or spent was irregular. It's in a sense, therefore, and that is why we emphasize the fact that it should be the Electoral Court who must, in the first instance, take that decision. The IEC can implement that decision, but it should not be their primary responsibility to determine that. With respect to the audits, if you look at the, just want to get the point in the bill. It says that for the purpose of that the parties must establish a number of accounts, bank accounts, in which these monies are paid, and that these accounts must be audited, and that the parties themselves must act as the accounting officers, and that the party must appoint their own auditors in order to do the auditing. Now, unfortunately, we have now some experiences of, I don't want to say it in too much sort of, or in a distorted fashion, but one can sometimes ask questions about what is the quality of the auditing that has taken place. It's in the news. So what we want to see is that, well, once it has been audited by political parties, they report it to the IEC. That is how we understand the bill. The IEC then, the Auditor General can decide whether the office is going to audit or not, as the auditor is doing with state departments in general. So they don't have to audit it necessarily, but they have the choice to do it. So it might be that in a certain year, the Auditor General won't see these reports. And it won't be therefore audited a second time by an external auditor who is not part of the party's auditing processes. And we want to make sure that because this has become something in the public interest, this public disclosure of the private funding, I mean, it has now been in the court here, the judgment of the My Vote Counts, that in order to create the credibility for what you are busy with, and by implication we as the public is busy with, that it must be audited by one who says, well, it is beyond the sort of the domain of the political parties themselves. So we are not saying the IEC must be audited in a differently. It is the parties' disclosure themselves, because nothing in the bill so far says that ultimately that audited reports must be presented here to Parliament. I don't see it in this bill. It says only a report from the Auditor General comes to Parliament, as well as the IEC's normal annual reports come here. But it can be part of a bigger report. So ultimately it can disappear in the bigger report. And we don't see it as being the focus of a specific report in terms of public disclosure. And then lastly, we talk about political parties. Your question about, you say that I think I misrepresented the point, is that it's not about represented parties are already well known because they are in the legislatures. But what we are referring to are registered parties registered already with the IEC. So it's not open-ended. There is the list on the website of the IEC. So anyone in the public can see these and these and these parties are already registered. Potentially they can whenever there's an election, they can participate in when they are going through the registration process for the specific election also. Because the point is, imagine here, in 1999, the UDM for the first time participated in an election. Up to that, if this legislation was applicable, after the election, they wouldn't have had to disclose anything. Because they were not yet a represented party. They were just a registered party with the IEC. In 2009, COPE was in exactly the same situation. Yes. So it means that you can, if you are formed 4 years before the next election, you can accumulate, receive how many donations. You can even become the next governing party. And you don't have to disclose anything of that if you are not a represented party. That's basically our point.
Yeah, no. I think we hear what you're saying, but we will get members to respond to it. I'm asking the question. The last point you made worries me a lot, because I think there's more than 200 registered parties. And you are saying that because he's not represented, although he's registered, there must be some monitoring of him. That's what you're saying. And I'm arguing that is very difficult to do. But members will help me out. Maybe I'm just slow today. That's the one thing. The second issue that I'm not understanding you, Prof. We are saying that the political party must make sure that the documents it gives to the IEC is audited and therefore credible. It goes to the IEC. The IEC's work is subject to the audit of the Auditor General. Your argument is that the Auditor General could go to the IEC and not get to the books of Party A, and therefore Party A would not be subjected to an audit outside of the audit of its party. Now, the Auditor General doesn't audit from A to Z, Honorable Gordy. I'm looking at you. He doesn't order from A to Z. He does samples. So your argument that it will not get there, I'm saying even if the Auditor General went to the IEC in year one, there's no guarantee that he's going to audit everything because he only does it by sample. And then what you're almost suggesting is that because it's in public interest, it must be audited independently type of thing. I buy your sentiment. I'm just saying, guys, let's be practical about what we're talking about. I buy it. I would want everybody to be audited, but even the department itself, the Auditor General audits now, is not subject to 100% audit. It's not subject to 100%. It's done by sample. And I'm not fighting with you, Prof. All I'm saying is that when members take these things into consideration, let us at least apply our minds to those things. So those are the two issues that I thought I would raise, and you'd have a second bite. But members, as usual, you'll have your second round, and then we'll ask them to respond, and then we will release them if necessary. I note, honorables, let's start with okay, let's go down the line this way first. Everybody will have a chance to have a second bite. Prof, you will take notes, and then we will afford you an opportunity to respond. Comrade Clark.
Thanks, Chair. I think on the last part of parties raised that, but I'm not represented in the legislature. I think it's true that it's not going to be possible that we make them accountable in terms of who's funding them. And it's easy for them to receive donations from outside the country and be funded by other governments. And I'm sure, we must think about it on how then do we deal with it, because I think we will not discuss about it. Yeah, I think one way or the other, we must find a way on how then do we include them. I'm not sure, but we must think about it. Thanks, Chair.
The Honourable Matei.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, UNISA, for your guidance and input on this drafting of this new bill. In terms of you recommending the change to the definition or the amendment to the definition of political parties to include just all those that are registered with the IEC, because you also know there's a lot of political parties that are not even active that are registered there. Are you recommending that they should also receive funding as well, or you come in here just to say, okay, we must be able to monitor their form of income or where they're receiving money from? And beyond that, as you say, there's a huge administrative task. I mean, it's hard enough for parties even to account, some political parties rather, to account for the political funding they receive now to the IEC and the IEC reporting. So we'd also like some recommendations on how you see how this could work. Would we be satisfied with them just submitting the annual reports to the IEC, and if they fail to do that consistently for a certain period, then they are automatically deregistered? But we have to look at, what can actually work rather than, the ideal of what we would like to see. But we did have discussions quite extensively, both also on entities as well, NGOs and those that are associated with political parties. And this is why we came up with the concept of having the multi-party democracy fund and encourage people to fund that and have that dispersed, and having the 100% disclosure so we also know where money is coming from and who and how political parties could be affected in that way. And that's how we thought we would deal with the issue of investment arms and NGOs and civil societies being attached to political parties, so we'd be able to monitor it from that way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Shah.
Thank you, Chair. You partly covered me here, but I have some misgivings about the practicality of some of the issues that you raised. I mean, in particular, policing the large number of political parties who are not represented. I mean, I think it's going to require an army of people to do that for very, very little reward. And in respect of the problem, to the extent it is a problem, of the EFF who burst on the scene 2014 and you can't account for their money, well, actually, good luck to them, in my view. Because it's very difficult to form a political party and to fight an election in such a way that you get representation. It's very difficult. As one of the other people said this morning, you know, they argued very strongly to remove the barrier of the deposit that has to be paid, which in itself is a hurdle that has to be overcome. So I really do think that on the balance of cost and benefit, we would be going down a very difficult path if we tried to police this for very little actual practical problem. Secondly, about auditing. Now, I don't know about other political parties, but we have a firm that is registered with the Auditing Council or whatever it is, and I mean, if our auditors were in a situation where they fraudulently audited our accounts, there would be their own disadvantage and their own penalties that would attach to them. So they're particularly careful because a political party is particularly under the spotlight. In addition, some of those audited statements come here to Parliament in respect of the constituency allowances. Some of them are provided to the IEC in terms of the Fund for Represented Political Parties Act. So it's not, I mean, even now there's a degree of disclosure. It's not that, you know, they're completely undisclosed. And I mean, as I understand it, all that will happen now is that instead of just those two streams of money being presented for publication, all the accounts will be presented for publication. So, you know, I really don't think that there's a problem in having to do yet another scrutiny, except on the random basis that the chairman was talking about. From time to time, the Auditor General will do a sampling to find out whether in fact the information is correct. Finally, just on your proposal to use the Electoral Court, you said that the Electoral Court has the status of a High Court, but it actually has the status of an Appeal Court. And the appeal from the Appeal Court is to the Common Court. So if it is the Court of First Instance, you're going to find the Common Court being used a great deal for appeals, which I'm sure is a situation which the Common Court doesn't want. And because of the way that the Common Court operates, I don't think it's geared to the sort of instantaneous adjudication of matters that are likely to characterize an election period, for example. So I just think in terms of embroiling or bringing in the Electoral Court does have its own disadvantages.
Thank you very much. Honourable Mulder.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Our mandate is basically derived from Section 236 of the Constitution that sets us in a certain direction with regard to participating parties that are already participating in legislatures. I think throughout the bill there is maybe a tension between two aspects. The one is the question of how do you deal with the funding of parties, and on the other hand, the question of transparency and disclosure. So I understand and Professor Kotze correctly pointed out that the emphasis was on the transparency and the disclosure part more than the funding part. So in all instances, you'll be dealing with two different perspectives in terms even of your definitions. If you talk about parties and you give a definition of parties, if they have funding in mind, you are bound by the constitutional wording to a certain extent and you refer to represented parties. If you look at the transparency part, it makes sense to look at the other aspect in terms of registered parties, to of the IEC, but you're working with two different entities in that regard. So that creates a little bit of a problem. Also with regard to what was referred to, the question of a member, the definition of a member, if you want to make it easier for parties to not to get into problematic situations regarding disclosure, you give that definition of what is a member, elected public representative, party official, etc. But on the other hand, won't that then again create a loophole in terms of funding, where I then don't give a donation to one of those, I give to a member directly, instead of I circumvent the provisions by giving to a member and not one of those specific ones. Then I think it's a valid point, the one that refers to donations by party to party. I think we should have a look at that as well. Thank you.
Honourable Gumede.
I'm fine, Chairperson, thank you.
Comrade Godi.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair. I think my little disadvantage is that the presentation was made when I was still out. And sitting and looking at that side, I'm sure if they had started when I was here, there's a question I would have loved to ask, but having gone into a lot of substantive issues, maybe I will let it pass. I'm always intrigued about accountability. Those who must account and those who call for accountability. Is it a one-way street? Is it a two-way street? But I suppose it's a midpoint at this point. Now, when one looks at, and I want to talk to the issue around the need to include parties that are registered with the IEC. I think the first part that Honorable Mulder spoke to a very large extent covered what I wanted to say. Sitting here, I was just amused how, when I look at the presentation, very scholarly and really goes into detail. I was asking myself how then did they miss the simple reality and fact that this bill seeks to give effect to a clause in the Constitution which then defines your parameters. Because it talks about a fund for representing political parties. So the moment you then deal with anything outside that, then maybe that requires a completely separate instrument. You know, like parties register with the IEC. What are the conditionalities for registration, continued registration at that level than at this point where we're saying how do we give effect legislatively to 236. So I felt if one looks at it in that context, then that issue would most obviously not even have arisen, or should not have arisen. Thank you, Coach.
Over to you, Prof.
Thanks, Chair, for all the questions. Maybe to start with the last point, and that is what we mentioned in the beginning of our presentation, the way in which we interpret 236 is, it says to enhance multi-party democracy, national legislation must provide for the funding of political parties. Now, our interpretation of it is that it refers to the two funds, or the first fund and now the second fund that is proposed. But it doesn't, so it is the public side of funding. It's not necessarily referring to the private side of funding, because it's not coming from Parliament and managed by the IEC. And that is why, I guess, up to now there was no challenge to this section in the Constitution to say, but you know, the fact that there's no reference to the public to the private funding means that it is, this current legislation is unconstitutional. or it's not meeting the requirements of the Constitution. And I think that's our dilemma, is how to interpret this bill. Whether, as I said in the beginning, whether it actually deals with two issues in one bill. One is the public funding, and then the creation of the two public funds, which is linked to the represented political parties. And that's how we understand it also. We take it for granted that that is applicable only to represented political parties. The public funding side, the coming from the proposed two funds. While the donation part, the private funding part, is open-ended. It's not confined only to the represented political parties. That's not the way in which we interpret 236. That it includes the public the private funding also. It's quiet on that.
You're creating a serious problem for us now. Yeah, because let me say what we there was a piece of legislation. What we're doing now is informed by 236. But in this legislation, we're saying over and above. In fact, the legislation that is currently there makes provision for private funding already. As the one that stands now makes provision for private funding, and that was informed by 236. All we're doing now is we're just splitting them, in other words, putting a clear boundary to them. When you say to us that 236 doesn't talk to private funding, I'm looking at members here. If I'm understanding correctly what the Prof is saying, that 236 doesn't talk to private funding, and therefore what we're doing here is, are you saying inconsistent to 236, or it's stretching 236 too far, or what is it that you are saying? Because my understanding is that we haven't done anything outside of 236. All we've done, you said there was one that the IEC looked at. Instead of having one, we're having two, and there was a specific reason why we say we're having two now. Because if I don't want to fund directly to a political party, I put it into this other one. But it's all informed by 236. All of it is informed by 236. Are you suggesting that your reading of 236 is that what we're doing is outside of 236? Is that what you're saying to us?
No, Chair. What I'm saying is that your legislation, this legislation, is not, in terms of the private component of it, is not confined to 236. And the reason why we are saying that is at the bottom of page 13 of the bill. It is in chapter 3, which is, its heading is direct funding of political parties. Our proposal is to change it to private donations to political parties, because it doesn't deal with the public part of it. There's a definition of political party. Well, under the definitions in the beginning, you have a definition of represented political party on page 8. But here you have another definition which is not the same as the one on page 8. And doesn't refer to registered political party. And because you have at the bottom of page 13, this the one that comes, the definition that comes from the Electoral Commission Act, which we think is not a good definition. Because if you interpret this, for example, Kusatu can be included as a political party here, in terms of this definition. Kusatu is an entity that accepts donations to support or oppose any registered party. So that means, therefore, it does not, and this is specifically now applicable to Chapter 3, which is what we are talking about.
Say that again. You think Kusatu accepts money to support or oppose?
Any registered party. Yes,
right.
Anyone else than the ANC in the party.
No, I agree. So
or any other entity. That was one of the first examples I thought.
No, I hear what you're saying. So I'm looking at that in terms of there's any number of organizations out there that support or oppose a political party. I'm looking at CASAC would support and oppose. I'm looking at Helen Susan Foundation, any number of them would support or oppose. So what are you saying? You're saying
that is why we proposed the alternative definition of a political party.
Which says what?
That they must be registered with the IEC as a political party.
Members are following that, of course. I'm hoping you guys are following it, because you guys are going to advise us afterwards, otherwise you'll have an offline meeting with these young men. Gordon?
No. I think I hear what he's saying, except that whatever you are, whether a political party or not, should be determined by substance. And not limited to if you are not registered with the IEC, then you are not a political party. And I suspect what informs that definition may not necessarily be a universal aspect in terms of how we understand and how we practice politics or exercise politics. To the extent that where the bill talks about representative political parties, meaning a party must contest elections, there you need to have registered with the IEC to contest. How material is it that to exist, be defined or define yourself as such, will then be limited to or be determined by whether or not you are registered? I'm not sure how material that is to the issues of, say, funding or the issues of accountability for that funding, if you have it privately.
We will mount some of these things over. If needs be, we will call you to help us offline. Certainly not us, but our drafters will call you. You can continue with the other question.
Thanks, Chair. I'm fully aware of what the practical difficulty of implementing all the things that we are saying. So I think the purpose of why we bring it to you is to say, take note of it, because there are some issues that are pertinent to this legislation, and I think the idea is always to have try to close the loopholes as best as possible. So we are not expecting from our side that everything, that there's practical sort of solutions for everything, but at least we want to make you aware of some of the implications of what is here. And also, to repeat a point that I've mentioned earlier on, is that just the exclusive focus on political parties are not going to close a lot of these loopholes. We are talking about political parties now, but all these other associated entities, like trust funds and companies and so on, are still there. And I think we don't expect you to address them necessarily now in this bill already, but it is something for the future. Now, I was in the past in a ministerial panel that dealt with the ownership by foreigners of property in South Africa. And that was one of our biggest issues about how to define the idea of a foreign company or a foreign entity, because there are so many possibilities for front organizations, for proxies and so on. And the same applies here. If you close the avenue towards political parties, then there's still many other avenues open. So our purpose, I think, as a university or a department, is to say, well, these things do exist, and we have to take them into account. The auditing, to make it very simple, personally, I would like that there should be a report like this on private donations at the end of each year, which is not necessarily in absolute detail, but it is available for the public, so that anyone can say, well, if it comes to the receiving of private donations, private funding in general, there is a report that's available to the public. And I think it's important from the public representative point of view, from Parliament and from your side, that this becomes available. I'd want to make sure that ultimately there is something like that once this legislation is accepted. That I guess is maybe the basic point. The point about the electoral court as being equal to an appeal court, yes, but at the time of elections, all issues, all the electoral disputes, if it's not resolved by the IEC, the liaison committees, go to the electoral court. So I think in a sense, we interpret it as similar to when matters of an electoral nature is taken to the electoral court as the responsible court. I'm not saying that the fact that the reason why we refer to the electoral court is because it's already referred to in the bill. It could have been another court, an Ordinary High Court or so, but we are not very specific about that. But the main point we want to make is that it should be removed from the domain of the IEC, because it complicates the credibility, the reputation of the IEC with respect to electoral issues ultimately. We don't want to complicate the work, already complicated work of the IEC even more. That's our basic argument.
Excuse me.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Prof, and your team. We will consider what you've said. I'm looking at Michael and Prof Cheadle and anybody else. If you guys need to have a beer or a coffee with the Prof, please do so, because you'll assist us in refining our legislation. Thank you very much, Prof, and to Ms. Khadebe. It is 5 minutes to lunch. I am reliably informed that we will have a very, what do you call it, not conservative, a very, I don't want to say cheap, that's the wrong word, but we're trying to with the meager funds that we have, provide a snack, a sandwich for those of you that are here. Please feel free to join us. It's nothing elaborate, it's nothing five-star. It should be five-star. It shouldn't be five-star, it's not five-star, it's very basic, but yeah, please feel free to join us. We will reconvene at 2 o'clock, and organization Undoing Tax Abuse, are they around? They are around, so you'll be the very first to talk to us after lunch. It'll then be followed by Senef around. There are. Senef, you will follow immediately after that. And then we would have Dr. G.S. and Mr. Bryant, I'm assuming they're here. G.S. and Bryant are here. And then we'll have Mr. Murray, and that will be the business for today, and we'll continue tomorrow. So that's the proceedings. Do we have to lock now? Yeah, so we can leave on that. Okay. Cindy's saying to me, lunch is here for everybody, but is appealing to members please to look at your SMS very quickly before we formally adjourn. Members should look at their SMSs. And for everybody else, we're having lunch here, so we will leave our documents here. The cameras are on, so don't try and steal our documents. We're leaving them here, so. Some of us will be joining you, others will go obviously to their offices or so, but members are free to leave your documents where they are. There will be somebody in the venue for the duration, and we will reconvene at 2 o'clock. Meeting is adjourned temporarily. Thank you very much.